Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. We're going to be talking about more news on the true cost of right-wing ideology, what charter schools are costing us, and what, they don't really work? Really? Really? And we're wasting tons of resources? Say it isn't so. Oh, the surprise. Oh, I'm shocked. Shocked. Utterly, utterly shocked. In my place, speechless. Cannot believe. Well, I can't believe what I've been saying for years, that it's a waste of money and we need to be looking in other, I don't know, maybe strengthening our public schools, maybe funding them adequately. Just a thought. We'll talk about that. Also, fast food workers are in the streets. Better wages, hours, conditions. Look, the demands of labor have not changed, nor will they change. And on the other side of it, neither have the divisive actions of the greed class. We'll talk to workers in Montana and Wisconsin who took part in today's strike. Today's also the 8th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. What does New Orleans look like today? Has privatization of education worked? What about the low wages? What about doing, if you remember, right after the Hurricane Bush did away with all those federal labor law things that just hamper work, just any of those wages that hamper things getting done, did away with all that. Has it worked? And also a report from our correspondent in Turkey on the situation on the ground there in Syria. Your thoughts, your questions, comments, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You can email me during the program at rick@thericksmithshow.com. Interesting story I came across on Reuters. This whole thing in Syria has, while there are some who are pounding their chest, the majority of people, I think, are like me, saying, well, hold on, let's not rush too quickly into this. In fact, most of the people I know are saying, we don't need another war. But who is happy for war? Well, oil companies. The report from Reuters pointed out that gas prices have already jumped up 2 cents per gallon, which I guess is the largest single day jump in months. Generally, you say, the big holidays coming up, gas prices go up. They're saying that, the oil, the Syria thing, it's going to jump. No, it's not going to jump as much as it did on 9/11. And I still remember driving home on 9/11, 2001, and gas prices going from about two something a gallon up to $8.50 a gallon by the time I got home. But not that crazy, but still a jump nonetheless. So it will be interesting to see what the coming days have to offer on this. Good news for Democrats in the state of Pennsylvania, I'll be honest. Good news for the people who are not a big fan of Tom Corbett. Polling numbers. Oh, gotta love the polling numbers for our governor. The latest poll has the governor 20% approval rating. Yeah, 20% of the people who responded to the Franklin and Marshall College poll, he deserves to be reelected. 69% say time for a change. And I look at this and I go, only 16% of the people in the poll said that he's doing a good or an excellent job through his first 30 months. You got to go, uh-oh. Could be the silly season. I'm hoping for a primary, hoping for a primary challenger, somewhere from the extreme right of the Republican Party, because that's all that's going to come out of the Republicans. Twitter Tom, the hide-and-seek man, he's not far enough to the extreme right. The interesting thing about the poll that the Franklin and Marshall College did, the respondents to the poll said the issues that were most important to them were the things that we've been talking about on this program from the beginning. It's about education. It's about schools and my kids' opportunity to the future. It's about the economy, unemployment, other economic interests. And it's about health care. Stuff that directly affects people's lives every day. Their kids, their jobs, their health, their security. Something that the Republicans have not even considered. Everything this governor has done, every movement that he has made has been to, well, to destroy public education by profitizing and privatizing it, to do nothing on the jobs front but say people are lazy, stupid, or they're drug addicts who can't pass a test. And on the economic front, what has he done to, well, he's called himself the more jobs governor, more than Wyoming, so I got to make that clear. Yeah, during his tenure, we've created more jobs than Wyoming, but the other problem is that there are a bunch of states ahead of us, like almost all of them. And his economic plan is big checks. We're going to give away our kids' future to these companies in the hopes that they'll come here, not bring any jobs, but they'll come. Or we'll give huge amounts of money for people who are going to come here anyway. That's the plan. And on the healthcare side of things, adult basic, CHIP, Medicaid expansion, all things he's been on the wrong side of. So I don't know how this guy gets reelected. I don't know how he gets, I don't know how he survives the primary challenge of any Republican at this point. I mean, you go back through the, you know, the 30 months, the time this guy's been governor, and there's really nothing you can point to say this was a good thing that he did. But Rick, he balanced three budgets on time. At whose expense? At what cost? At what cost to the future? You know, I could say, you know, I paid all my bills last month, but the huge hole in the roof got a foot bigger and all my furniture's ruined. But hey, I paid my bill on time last month. Very tip of the nose, very short-sighted. And look, at the end of the day, it's all about ideology and his no tax pledge, which now the Republicans are saying he broke because of the gas tax, because heaven forbid we need a transportation bill. So I find it very interesting that this governor keeps stepping all over himself. And in fact, it didn't get any better yesterday. If you saw the story that came out of Montgomery County where the Corbin administration filed a lawsuit, you know, trying to stop the same-sex marriage licenses in Montgomery County that were issued. And you remember we talked with Bruce Haynes the day after he issued the marriage license to same-sex couples. And he said, look, he believed it was unconstitutional. He's doing the right thing. And I believe he's right. But the Corbett administration, they've got to go and they filed a lawsuit. They're trying to block it. And what's interesting is their argument. And it's one of those things where you just go, man, you're just making it worse. You're just proving how far off the path you are. In the brief, they said that the license that, you know, these licenses that were given out were never valid. And or they had no actual, how did it go? No actual value or legitimacy. They wrote, quote, had the clerk issued marriage licenses to 12-year-olds in violation of state law, would anyone seriously contend that each 12-year-old is entitled to a hearing on the validity of his license? Wow, could you be any more condescending? Because you people are just, you aren't real adults. And you're just children that need to be controlled. This is the mindset of the people who are running our government. It's quite interesting. And look, they're on the wrong side of history on this. And they're going to be held accountable for it, I believe, next November at the ballot box, as they should. Dan Frankel, representative out the Allegheny County Way, had an interesting op-ed about Labor Day. And Labor Day is coming up, the big holiday and all. But it's more than just barbecues and a day off. It's about remembering what it took to build the middle class, what it's going to take to maintain and to grow it again, what we need to be doing to salvage what's left of our standard of living and return to a growing middle class again. But he had an interesting piece on same-sex marriage and, you know, basically on gays and lesbians in the workplace, which most people don't realize that you can be fired for being a gay man or a lesbian woman or whatever. You can be fired for for what you do within the confines of your fault. Not doing it on the job, because you get fired for that with a heterosexual couple. But what you do in the confines of your own home. And there's nothing legally to stop you. And, you know, he went through this long piece, and it's well written, you know, supporting House Bill 300, which he says has 90 House co-sponsors and 25 co-sponsors in the Senate. That would say, you know, you can't fire someone based on their sexual preference. And I'm all in favor of that. And he points to a statistic that says 72% of the people in the state of Pennsylvania, they support fairness on the job and in firing and hiring practices. And I'm with him. I'm absolutely with him. There should, in no way, shape, or form, should you be fired for what you do within the confines of your four wall with consenting adults. It's just insane. But you also go beyond that. Should you be fired because, well, you wore purple socks today, or because you drive a certain kind of car, or because I just don't like you? Should that be allowed? And for me, I look at all of this stuff. This is more of a reason for people to organize, more of a reason to have a contract. Because the only way in this Commonwealth, and in a lot of at-will employment states, because understand, in Pennsylvania, you are an at-will employee. The servant and master relationship is well documented, well kept. And if you're the servant, well, you're disposable for any reason imaginable or no reason whatsoever. I've always said there needs to be in the workplace a contract. Look, it's not that you can't fire someone. It's not that you can't get rid of someone. But it's got to be for cause. And it's got to be something that's laid out. This is what it is. But we have, in I'm not sure why, but we've allowed this law to continue. And I think, you know, I think Frankel's piece is an interesting read on that front, and something we should be expanding to all working people. That protection, that basic fairness and sanity. Just a thought. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about charter schools, some of the funding. Does it work? Does it not? The Auditor General's got a new report out. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. On the talk. We want the world and we want it now. We're going to take it anyhow. We want the airwaves.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Here's today's headlines from Workers Independent News. I'm Jesse Russell. It isn't often mentioned when people discuss the 1963 March on Washington, but after Martin Luther King Jr. spoke, Barrett Rustin took the stage to read a list of 8 demands being delivered to the government. One of those demands spoke directly to an issue grabbing headlines today, as thousands of retail and fast food workers across the country walk off the job, demanding better wages.
We demand that there be an increase in the national minimum wage so that men may live in dignity.
In 1963, the minimum wage was $1.25 per hour, or $9.52 per hour when adjusted for inflation. Today, the federal minimum wage is $7.25 per hour, below where it was 50 years ago. At the march, the demand was for a wage of $2 per hour, which would be the equivalent of $14.80 per hour when adjusted for inflation. The workers on strike today are calling for an increase in the minimum wage to $15 per hour, nearly the same amount that was demanded in 1963. Julian Bond referenced the walkout in his speech and called on those attending to not sit on the sidelines as dreamers, but instead to be doers.
And so as we go home today, let us remember that the dreamer was also a doer. And as we turn on our TVs tomorrow and see people walking out of places where they're being forced to survive on 725 by the thousands, let us commit to join them in fighting to lift up the bottom. Because as the top of that ladder has extended, tethers at the bottom must be unleashed.
Many of the speakers called for a recommitment to the fight for a living wage. Service Employees International Union President Mary Kay Henry.
Joining together to create good jobs by supporting workers all across this country who have the guts to stand up, join together, and demand a living wage from their employers.
AFSCME President Lee Saunders said the guiding principle should be that everyone share equally in the prosperity of the nation.
We must uphold the principle that everyone who contributes to the prosperity of this nation should share in the prosperity of our nation.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
And I think it's going to be awakening to us because just like the schools, when we cut the funding for schools, now we've put it back in the budget, so they really didn't get cut. But I think now schools are starting to step up to the plate and look how they can maybe partner with private people to bring education like better into the schools.
Inequality I just ignore. Don't know what a golden rule is for. But I do know a thing or two. And if all the states were red, no blue, what a wonderful world.
Representative Sue Helm there. We took the money, but we put it all back, you know, except for that $1 billion each of the last 3 years. But we put it all back. But we should be privatizing and bringing those private companies in. I look at this recent survey by the National School Supply and Equipment Association. They found that a whopping 99.5% of the people they surveyed dug into their own pockets to buy basic classroom supplies. According to the surveys, teachers spent on average about $485 of their own dwindling paycheck over the course of last year to ensure that their students had what they needed in the classroom. Now, you put that next to this latest press release from Auditor General Eugene DePasquale, who points out that the Pennsylvania Department of Education approved something like $2 million in improper lease reimbursements to these charter schools. I wonder how many teachers wouldn't have to dig into their pockets if that $2 million actually made it into the classroom. Well, here to talk to us about the report and the report of the direction of charters and education in the state is Auditor General Eugene DePasquale. Eugene, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, always a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
I look at this and, I got to be honest with you, $2 million seems awful low to me with all of the reports from around the country. I'm seeing these charter operators taking vacations, lining their pockets, paying their relatives, all of the shenanigans that are going on.
Yeah, it's only from seven audits, though. So it's really, we're going to probably have a different number after we complete our cycle through all the charters, but that's from seven charters. One of them was $1.2 million alone.
How many charters are there in the Commonwealth?
About 157 have been chartered.
And you've only had time to do seven. Why is that? I mean, the massive staff you've got over there should be able to zip this out in no time, right?
Yeah, although it's been a 24% cut in staff over the last 3 years. When Barbara Hafer was Auditor General, the department had 900 employees. We're now down to 475.
That's almost in half.
Yeah, and it's been 24% in the last 3 years.
So how are we supposed – I guess we're not supposed to. We're not supposed to do all these audits, right?
That is why I've been – this has been one of the reasons why I've been working so hard with my leadership team to become even more efficient and try to use more technology so that we can get to more audits with the dramatically lower staff that we have. Somebody said, why make a big deal about purchasing six scanners? Well, that's enabled us to cut the audit review time of liquor stores, which helps them become more profitable, more effective, more consumer-friendly, and we can find out things are doing wrong and improve them from 250 days down to 60 days. And it's that type of we're trying to instill those type of changes all throughout the department. But the reality is human beings are human beings. When you go from 900 to 475, it's just harder.
Yeah, there's only so many hours in the day that someone can put into this. But you make an interesting point, and I've heard from other people who run departments in our state government that the equipment, the computers, and everything so antiquated that it takes probably twice as long as it needs to. And I remember talking to a woman I know over at Department of Treasury who said that they wanted to hold like a webinar.
Right.
And the guy who was facilitating it said that the computer network that the state has is like five generations too old, and they couldn't do this webinar with the equipment that they have.
We are in the exact same boat right now. In fact, when I took office, we wanted to switch to everything being electronic as opposed to printing all these paper copies, save paper, better for the environment, et cetera. Well, our server crashed after 2 days.
That's not a good thing. But, you know, here I look at this, and I look at the defunding of the Auditor General's office. I look at the defunding of regulatory oversight or anything that's going to hold people like these charter schools accountable. And I think this is all by design. Basically, the lobbyists want to make sure that government doesn't have the ability to oversee what's going on so they can rob us blind.
The Grover-Norquist design is that you get it so that government is ineffective. And then when government becomes ineffective, then people lose faith in it. I'm not saying every person on the Republican or the conservative ideology believes that, but that has been his mission. And as we know, he has driven a lot more influence in the party over the last decade than he did certainly in the previous decade. And it is now impacting a situation now where you have literally United States senators saying if one government program, now it's the Affordable Care Act, but if one government program is not defunded, they're willing to shut down the government and default on our debt. That is insane, crazy talk, but this isn't just some fringe element. These are a significant number of United States senators that are saying that.
Yeah, and that's scary stuff. I mean, a lot of the stuff I'm seeing coming out of the extreme political right, and I tell my Republican friends, look, your party's gone off the wagon. We need to bring them back to the path. We need to bring them back to some sanity. Because things are falling apart. We can't do simple, basic things like pass a transportation bill to get the damn roads and bridges fixed.
And now they're forced to put weight restrictions on. But whether it's less auditors in the Auditor General's office or not funding bridges, and you can obviously, depending on your point of view, which of these items is more important. Obviously, the number one priority is funding of our schools. But one of the things that I'm seeing as Auditor General is the real impact of these cuts. For example, a lot of people have asked, do you believe, the governor's design that, that the accountability isn't taking hold at the charters? I said, actually, what our evidence so far is that there just literally aren't enough people to enforce the existing rules.
Right.
So I'm not saying that there's and the same thing goes with agriculture. The amusement ride inspection program went from 9 people to 4. Oh, that's going to have an impact. There's an impact to having less people, whether it's food inspectors, a border inspector, the list goes on and on and on. There is an impact on less than everything. And these weren't done because there was a really thoughtful study done and we decided, well, we need more people here and less people there to be more cost effective. No, this is just an across the board whack.
Yeah, it was done with a meat axe and based on ideology. And we've been hearing for 30 years that we need to deregulate. And look, it hasn't made things better. It hasn't made business better. It hasn't made consumers' rights better. I'd say it's made things much worse. And the fact that there are only, 4 people inspecting the amusement rides now makes me think, well, I'm not doing that again.
Yeah, and in fairness, I will say most of the places where you would want to be really cognizant of this is these smaller fairs.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I'll never do that again.
Yeah, the larger parks obviously have their own vibrant inspection system. But the smaller fairs, I'm not sure we're not convinced that there's a full inspection going on here.
And the thing is when you start talking about all the money that's being cut for education, I look at all of this waste, fraud, and abuse. If you want to talk about waste, fraud, and abuse, look at all of these charter operators who are being brought up on crimes, who are ended up in jail. The guy at the Hammurabi school in Philadelphia, I mean, you could tick off 20 or 30 of them across the country where millions of dollars have been stolen and misused.
What we are seeing is that at least in some of them, not certainly not all, but at least a pretty large chunk so far, that they've created this circular system on how they can get lease reimbursements, which they should not be getting because of the connection between who owns the property and who owns the school. But what we've done is we've started actually checking the deed. That's how we're finding this. We're going to the county and we're looking at the deed, and that's how we have found this. And that's what we're really trying desperately to get the Department of Education to wake up on this and say, look, we're telling you where your own regulation is not being enforced. All we can do is, as Auditor General, is tell you after it happened. You guys, that department, if you work with us on this, we can actually stop the payment from getting made, because it is a lot easier to stop a payment yep. than it is to get the money back.
Absolutely. And, you know, the thing that gets me is all of this money that we're spending on the properties and the intellectual property stuff that's being propped up. That's money being taken out of the classroom, like I said, $485.
Absolutely.
Each teacher's digging into their own dwindling pay to put things into the classroom. So dwindling teacher pay, less opportunity for the kids. And I got to be honest. You know, I'm just not seeing the benefit to dividing and conquering our public school system. I just haven't seen the studies that have shown me it's working. And beyond that, it's taken money out of my kids' class. My sixth grade daughter came home from their first day at school the other day. Says, Dad, you know, I'm in a class with 100 people. It's LGI. I go, what's LGI? Oh, it's large group instruction. I'm going, you're in sixth grade. What are you doing sitting
grade,
in a university-sized class?
That's supposed to be maybe your freshman geology class
exactly.
at Penn State or something. I mean, that's crazy. It just does. And what are those kids getting out of that? You know, they're going to start to daydream and zone off.
Exactly. And you know, my fear in all this is, you know, look, you know, I live in a pretty decent neighborhood. The school district hasn't been hurt as much as, you know, Harrisburg or York or Philadelphia, but they're still being hurt. And every school district across the state is being hurt by these cuts and by this wasted resource going off to some of these charter operators.
The idea behind the charters at the beginning was that they were supposed to have some flexibility and experimentation to try some different techniques. That was the idea. They were not supposed to be just a different public school down the street run by a private company. That was never the idea behind this. And that's why there really needs to be an overhaul of the law so that we can get back to really what the intent of the charter school idea was. Today, in many of the communities, it's simply just another public school run by a private company down the street.
Is there any appetite in the legislature for doing any of this? I know we've had James Roebuck on the program a number of times. He's got some reforms that he says could save a boatload of money for the school districts in Philadelphia by doing some of the things that you've said. Any appetite for it?
So far the answer is no, but I do think that the pressure is starting to change. When you have somebody out in Beaver County with an 11-count indictment and the millions of dollars that was siphoned away, that is not going unnoticed. And we just have to keep the drumbeat up. Tough things can happen when you don't give up.
Yeah, I'm with you. But, you know, what do you say to the person? Because I've got friends who absolutely believe that the public schools are broken. They're failing. All the schools are failing because I hear it in the news. And yet, I'm sorry, I see the schools being defunded. I see them struggling to meet what they need because they don't have the resources to do it. I don't know necessarily failing.
Look, this is – it's very frustrating when I hear stuff like that. I'm not saying frustrating you say it. I know people say that. First of all, if you would have had these same standards in 1950 without segregated classrooms, everybody in the classroom – everybody having to get educated, meaning like, you know, you didn't get the, you know, back then, you know, kids with disabilities got put in the closet.
Yep.
You know, so just put the same environment today, which I think is obviously the right thing to do, where you're giving everyone a shot. And then throw in these high level test scores that they have to meet under No Child Left Behind. I'm telling you, to say that the same problems wouldn't have been exposed in 1920, 30, 40, or 50 is just fantasy land.
So is the in fact,
I would make you can make a pretty compelling argument that the standards that the schools are trying to meet today are the highest that have ever tried to be met in this country when you're talking about an across the board standard.
I'm with you, but would you then say that the the language put in with No Child Left Behind, in specific, the 100% pass rate by 2014, which I understand the Commonwealth just got a waiver on. Would you say that that it was put in there as the poison pill to destroy public education?
I had always felt that whenever you say anybody, well, not just one child or one group, when you're talking about an across the board 100%, or you're determined to fail, that was meant so that one day every headline in every newspaper would say our school is failing, and that people would give up on it.
So getting back to your report, how do we undo this? How do we put pressure on the people who need to take action so that we're not wasting millions of dollars on land acquisition deals and on all the schemes that we've seen popping up around the Commonwealth and around the country? What do we do?
In the short run, it's a very simple solution to what we found. The Department of Education needs to go back to needing to see a copy of the deed and doing their own investigation on who owns the land and whether the lease reimbursement is proper as opposed to just rubber stamping it. It is very simple. They will find the exact same stuff that we've had. It's not like we're the NSA. We're not doing eavesdropping. We're not doing any of that stuff. We're just literally going to the county of record, looking at the deed, looking at the original charter, and making the connection. It's
yeah.
that simple.
But you need to have people in those jobs actually doing those.
That's right. Somebody has to be there doing it. There's no question.
Yeah, that goes against the whole ideology. That kind of breaks down right when you start. Because since this guy's been governor, I don't know if you saw his polling numbers. I think the citizens of the Commonwealth are starting to wake up to our governor and his ways. But very proud that they've cut government by a pretty sizable chunk over the last 2.5 years.
Pennsylvania, I think, now is either next to the bottom or has the fewest amount of state employees per capita in the country.
Yeah, only South Carolina has a lower number.
Yeah, I knew we were, and so that's pretty. I mean, look, if you're trying to enforce a regulation, but you don't have people to enforce it, that's really not effective. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, it's interesting. South Carolina, where our governor bought a vacation home, hopefully soon to be his permanent vacation home. Auditor General, it was great talking to you. I appreciate you taking time for us.
Rick, thanks for having me on. Always a pleasure.
Thanks so much, Auditor General Eugene DePasquale. Quick break, right back, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people on the top.
Blue in an ocean of red. Rick Smith.
Stop paying high interest rates for the promise of small rewards. Get the PSECU Visa card instead. No games, no gimmicks. Just a low 9.9 annual percentage rate. Then get the greatest reward of all, paying less for the things you want. PSECU, financing life is what we do best.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit psecu.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
America's economic recovery can be measured not only in the performance of stocks, but also of socks. Most economists, pundits, and politicos see the boom in the stock market and say, see, the recovery is going splendidly. But if they went to such stores as Kohl's, Target, and Walmart to find out what's selling, the answer would be socks. Even in the present back-to-school season, usually the second biggest buying spree of the year, sales are sluggish at best, customers foregoing any spending on their kids except for socks, underwear, and other essentials. This is not only an economic indicator, but also a gauge of the widening inequality in America. The highly ballyhooed recovery has been restricted to the few at the top who own the stocks, get paychecks of more than $100,000 a year, and buy BMWs. But meanwhile, the many don't have any cash to spare on necessities. Walmart's chief financial officer seems puzzled that there is, as he puts it, a general reluctance of customers to spend on discretionary items. Golly, sir, could it be because job growth in our supremely wealthy country has been both lackluster and miserly? Yes, for jobs today are typically very low-paying, part-time, and temporary, with no benefits. Mr. Walmart man should know this, since his retail behemoth is the leading culprit in downsizing American jobs to a poverty level. In recent months, headquarters has directed Walmart managers not to hire at all or to concentrate on hiring temporary and part-time workers, while cutting the hours of many full-time employees and making it harder for all workers to get the corporation's meager health care plan. This is Jim Hightower saying, Walmart's sales and profits are stagnant today because, hello, even its own workers can't afford to buy anything in the store besides socks.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Sanity for a change. The Rick Smith Show.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. So, on Saturday, Eric Schneiderman, the Attorney General there in New York, filed a lawsuit against the Donald $40 million lawsuit, you know, saying, look, you know, no matter how rich and famous you are, no one has the right to scam hardworking New Yorkers. Anyone who does should expect to be held accountable. And, you know, Trump, predictably, went to Twitter and called Schneiderman names, called him a lightweight, said he was trying to extort him, and said that 98% of the people who were his former students were thrilled, satisfied, completely satisfied with their $35,000 full education from Trump University. Well, it didn't take long for people to come out of the woodwork and say, I'm not thrilled. I got screwed. I spent $35, this one guy said, Bob Giulio, who said he left the sessions at Trump University cash poor, said that he basically got little more than a picture with him and a cardboard cutout of the Donald, who never bothered to come to the Trump University, which I guess was part of the whole sales pitch, that you get to meet the Donald and rub the hair or something. I don't know. Maybe the hair has magical powers. Don't know. But a bunch of people are now saying, whoa, we expected, you know, certain things, found out everything that they were teaching us. We could have Googled, could have found it on the internet for not $35,000. He said, you know, one of the people that he took a course from, one of the quote unquote instructors, kept flashing his Rolex, and wearing his, you know, expensive suit and cufflinks and fancy cufflinks. Told us his rags to riches story. Said, you can be it too. And I'm looking at this and I'm going, what nimwit would jump into the middle of this? And I guess it comes down to, we always think there's something better out there. And I bring this back to public education. We keep telling people, oh, well, you could get better if we just privatize. We put it in the hands of successful people like the Donald, without really understanding that the Donald wasn't self-made. The Donald made the right choice. And, you know, going back to what Representative Reid said, the chairman of the Republican Policy Committee here in the state of Pennsylvania, when he was talking about his poverty initiative, you know, sometimes you just make one bad decision, one bad choice. Well, Donald made the first choice right. He was born to the right family. Came out of the right, you know what. And all of that came with that, all of the invisible capital, all of the doors that swung wide open because he was the Trump's son. All of the opportunity that none of these people who spent $35,000 to you know, pet the hair ever going to get. It's not like you're going to walk into a room and go, I touched the Donald's hair. Open the doors for me. It doesn't happen. But what they did get is they got scammed. They got ripped off. And are you surprised? You know, it's any of these too good to be true scenarios. this whole promise of the charter school thing that has been, that has morphed away from what Eugene DePasquale just said. They were supposed to be public schools that did things a little different. Laboratories of innovation. Ways where we were going to do things a little different, but in the control of you and me and parents, we the people, our schools. And what they've turned into through massive lobbying campaigns and huge billionaire money are these little generators of profit and malfeasance. You know, I point to the story in Vernet Public Schools in Houston. According to reports there, $5.3 million in federal funds. Who knows? I don't know. You know, first class airline tickets, you know, my credit card needed to pay. We took a cruise. You know, I needed tickets to Disney on Ice. The woman who's the superintendent of the Varnett schools, Annetta Clough, and her husband, Elsie Clough. You know, they got credit card bills, you know, and it was just there. They had a lot of money, and it was, you know, it's there. But what happens to that $5.3 million that comes out of the classroom? That's money that you and me and other taxpayers think, hey, that money's going to the kids. We pay our taxes and, you know, so we're paying high taxes. But you know what? The next generation is going to learn something. Then we find out that these charter operators are robbing us blind. You know, not just recently, that the one in Philadelphia, the Harambee or whatever it is, he just pled guilty, misappropriating funds. I mean, stealing funds, lining his own pockets. Pled guilty to wire fraud, stealing school funds. Not to mention, a couple of years before, it was using the school as a bar. But you know, hey, it's that. Laboratory of innovation, kids and booze, throw some lottery tickets in there, and it'd be the learning experience of a lifetime. The reality is there have been at least 18 charter schools in the Philadelphia area that have been subject to federal investigation since 2008. How many public schools do you know of that are being investigated for financial malfeasance? How many public schools do you know are locking people up for millions of dollars in theft? How many of them have these land deals that... I look at this report by Dan Denver of the City Paper in Philadelphia. And he goes through and he talks about this Asperia Incorporated of Pennsylvania, which evidently started off on the right path, started off with the right intentions of providing services to the small Puerto Rican community there. But because of massive investment by the very well-to-do, they're now one of the largest charter school operators in the city of Philadelphia. And what he points out in his piece is you've got these land deals that, and we're seeing this all across the country where, you know what, we got a building, you know, we'll lease it back to ourselves. We'll fund the purchase of the building. And then once the charter school goes, we've got the property. So you and I mean, stop and think about this for a second. You and I and the diminished opportunity for our kids are buying property for the very well-to-do that eventually is not ours, but we paid for it. This is one of those moments where you look at these schools and you go, exactly why are we doing this? Exactly why are we setting up these situations where people put their relatives on the board of directors? Not the school board that's elected and held accountable to you and me. No, no, no. No, no. The person who gets the charter, they you know, Aunt Mabel needs a job. And she needs a six-figure job. With a car and a driver and a vacation and all of that, healthcare, all that stuff that we're begrudging our teachers of. And, you know, Uncle So-and-so and, you know, the nephew needs a job. And so it's basically just patronage on steroids. And you and I, the taxpayers, thinking that we're funding our children's future, are paying for all of this. And we turn on the radio and we look at the TV and we see the huge billboards like, oh, this charter school and cyber charter, the way to go. All of this nonsensical BS advertising that's meant to go, oh, it must be good. It's all over the radio. They're spending loads of money on your money, dimwit. Why is the right not infuriated by that? Why is the right, because, you know, hey, you know, got to get rid of the waste, fraud, and abuse. Where are the Republicans who, that seems to be imprinted on their tuchus? Waste, fraud, and abuse, everything. Waste, fraud, and abuse, except for these charter schools. Except for the money that they give to the people who give them campaign cash. Oh, I'm sorry. I think we figured that one out, didn't we? The people who fund them are the very people that are robbing us blind. And I got to be honest, I wouldn't mind so much being robbed blind as it is that I'm being robbed blind and my kid doesn't have the opportunity that they should have. Look, I mean, it absolutely blew my mind the other day when my daughter came home from her second day of school and said, yeah, we had LGI today. I'm going, what's LGI? Large group instruction. I go, what's that? Well, we're in like this auditorium. There's like 100 of us on the white team or the green team. And we have basically a lecture going in sixth grade. Really? And I'm going to look into this more because I cannot believe, not that I doubt my daughter's telling the truth, but I just, I'm struggling to wrap my head around how you put 100 sixth grade kids into a room and expect them to pay attention to one or two teachers. I'm baffled, beyond confused. But what it does do is it does solidify my belief that we're turning public education into warehousing, which is what the right wants. Follow instruction, bring in your see-through backpack, be a little conformist, march in a straight line, do what you're told, never ask a question. That's what we're doing to education, folks. And oh, by the way, there's got to be a profit margin to it. I hope I'm not the only one who sees this and the only one who's really ticked off by it. Look, I'm not against innovation. I'm not against trying new things. I am completely dead set, 110% against using my tax dollars that's supposed to go into that classroom to teach my kids and your kids and our grandkids, having that money taken and used for vacations or for patronage jobs or land deals to have nonprofit or profit corporations acquire land. I'm against it 100%. And we better wake up because all of the money that we think we're spending on education is being, a nice portion of it, being diverted away and, my other favorite part, intellectual propertized. Sad stuff. Let's take a quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Thought back to America. Rick Smith.
The 19th century saw regular work weeks of 70 hours or more. Many attempts were made to get legislatures across the country to pass maximum hour laws limiting the number of hours an employee could be compelled to labor. The first union victory in capping work hours was won by the building trades in 1840. They won a 60-hour week. In 1874, the state of Massachusetts became the first to pass a law mandating a maximum hours for women. Other states followed as union activists around the country fought to pass laws to protect workers. Their work stalled in 1905 when the U.S. U.S. Supreme Court ruled the New York Bake Shop Act unconstitutional, citing a sacred bond between master and employee and the liberty of contract. With this decision, the Lochner error, named after bakery owner Joseph Lochner, who had been cited, tried, and convicted of working employees beyond the 60-hour limit, began. This single decision opened the floodgates, allowing attacks on child labor laws, minimum wage laws, as well as maximum hour laws by corporate and anti-union interests. Only after President Franklin Delano Roosevelt threatened to enlarge the United States Supreme Court from 9 to 13 did the court do an about-face with regard to liberty of contract and what has been called a switch in time to save 9, ruling in West Coast Hotel versus Parrish that Elsie Parrish was indeed entitled to the state of Washington's minimum wage, regardless of what conditions she agreed to, marking the end of the Lochner era. FDR's New Deal policies helped workers reclaim lost ground in their fight for the American dream. The proposal and passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, federally restricting weekly hours, mandating overtime pay, setting a minimum wage, and restricting the exploitive use of child labor was an essential step forward for workers, families, and communities. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center of IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
And finally, we don't have unions in South Carolina. I wear heels, and it's not for a fashion statement. It's because we kick, and we kick those unions hard, and they will not step foot in the state of South Carolina.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Nikki Haley. Yeah, maybe when Governor Corbett gets railroaded, when he gets run out of Dodge here, maybe down to South Carolina. Infuriating stuff. Anyway, an interesting story from Oregon. A Portland man was sick, evidently. Decided that I can't afford health care. Can't pay for it. The pay-or-die system not working. The Affordable Care Act's not in place yet. So he walks into the bank, tells the teller, gives the teller a note, says, hold up, give me a dollar. He took his dollar, sat quietly in the lobby waiting for the cops to come, and they arrested him. What's that say about our society? Guy's homeless, no criminal record. He was arrested without incident, charged with second-degree robbery, and the bail set at $250,000. Because he's sick. The lengths you have to go to. And, you know, we've been hearing an awful lot from the right in this country about Obamacare is the end of the world. Oh, we need to defund it so we can go to this, pay or die. Or die, or rob a bank and go to jail and get the health care you need and probably die in jail. Or just die. A neighbor of mine came over the other day as I was working on my home office, because part of what we're doing here at the program is I need a space at home where I can work, so I'm redoing my shed to turn it into an office. And my buddy Larry came over and he said, you know, tell me if this is about Obamacare. Evidently his wife, who works for a government agency, evidently they said, we're not going to cover your family anymore. We're going to cover you, but not your family. And, you know, basically we said, well, see, this is what Obamacare, and all of her coworkers are saying, this is Obamacare is doing. And I'm saying, no, wait a second. No. It's not the Affordable Care Act. This is opportunism. This is the fact that you get a governor who cut funding to the county level, who then saw cuts to the local level. All of the tax cuts and all of the spending cuts that this guy's put into place, it rolls downhill. You know that, don't you? And Obamacare is just that's the excuse, because it hasn't gone into effect yet. And in fact, what we're seeing, do you remember last week when UPS said that they were going to do the same thing? They weren't going to cover the spouses of, I think it was like 15,000 of their non-union employees, which for me, you know, Hello, people? Pretty good reason why you have a collective bargaining agreement, just a thought, because they can't just arbitrarily do things without negotiating like they do with their management people. Who, management people? You can join a union, too. But, you know, arbitrarily, just decided 15,000 spouses, you're not getting the coverage. Go get your own. Bye-bye family health care. And everyone goes, oh, it's Obamacare. Obamacare did this. It had nothing to do with the Affordable Care Act. It was purely opportunism. It was, hey, we're going to do it. We're going to save us money, and we're going to pass it along to you or to whatever government agency or whoever else is at the end of the line. And this is what I was telling my buddy Larry. Look, what they've done is, look, their budgets have shrank because the state has cut the funding to the county level, which means that the county's got to figure out how they're going to pay their bills, which means, sorry, you and your family are going to see a cut in your health care, which means either you pick up a policy to cover the rest of the family, or you're just SOL. Well, fortunately, he works for, you know, a local government agency who, you know, he'll be able to get insurance through that. But here again, it's going to cost the local government more money. So you go, wait a second. So the state cut money to the county. The county cuts money to their employees, and it rolls downhill, doesn't it? In big, heaping, steaming piles. And the answer is yes. And the culprit was Obamacare's fault. You know, it's kind of like the people who we hear crying about coal. Obama has a war on coal because they're shutting down all of these coal-fire electric plants, basically because, you know, it's natural gas is cheaper, and it's a good time to do it because you got someone to blame, even though you were going to do it anyway, because you got a finger to point. Hey, it's Obama. Obama has a war on coal. And you get dim-witted, puddle-brained flag monkeys who run around going, yes, yes, it's Obama. Another big mistake, America. Uh-huh. And I look at this and I go, you know, it's like the guy in Sebattis, Maine, Dave Marsters, who is evidently a candidate for a local town position, a very conservative guy up there in Maine, who put on his Facebook page that people should shoot the end guy. Yeah. Shoot him in the head, because evidently, one of the big myths about Obamacare is that, well, we're taking health care away from the wife. Not that it's has nothing to do with Obamacare. It's your employer who's doing it. But he, you know, he goes on this rant. You know, it's that a-hole in the White House. We're going to lose our benefits because of him, which is nonsense. But it's a nice place to point the finger, isn't it? Yeah. It's always easy to blame the black guy in the White House. Always. Always. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. And, of course, if you have a smartphone, get the Stitcher app, take the podcast on the go. Quick break. Right back with Hour 2. Stick around.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
Here's today's headlines from Workers Independent News. I'm Jesse Russell.
It isn't often mentioned when people discuss the 1963 March on Washington, but after Martin Luther King Jr. spoke, Barrett Rustin took the stage to read a list of 8 demands being delivered to the government. One of those demands spoke directly to an issue grabbing headlines today, as thousands of retail and fast food workers across the country walk off the job, demanding better wages.
We demand that there be an increase in the national minimum wage so that men may live in dignity.
In 1963, the minimum wage was $1.25 per hour, or $9.52 per hour when adjusted for inflation. Today, the federal minimum wage is $7.25 per hour, below where it was 50 years ago. At the march, the demand was for a wage of $2 per hour, which would be the equivalent of $14.80 per hour when adjusted for inflation. The workers on strike today are calling for an increase in the minimum wage to $15 per hour, nearly the same amount that was demanded in 1963. Julian Bond referenced the walkout in his speech and called on those attending to not sit on the sidelines as dreamers, but instead to be doers.
And so as we go home today, let us remember that the dreamer was also a doer. And as we turn on our TVs tomorrow and see people walking out of places where they're being forced to survive on 725 by the thousands, let us commit to join them in fighting to lift up the bottom. Because as the top of that ladder has extended, the tethers at the bottom must be unleashed.
Many of the speakers called for a recommitment to the fight for a living wage. Service Employees International Union President Mary Kay Henry.
Joining together to create good jobs by supporting workers all across this country who have the guts to stand up, join together, and demand a living wage from their employers.
AFSCME President Lee Saunders said the guiding principle should be that everyone share equally in the prosperity of the nation.
We must uphold the principle that everyone who contributes to the prosperity of this nation should share in the prosperity of our nation.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
If it keeps on raining, let me go and pray. If it keeps on raining, let me go and pray.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So it was 8 years ago today, the year 2005, that Hurricane Katrina slammed into the U.S. Gulf Coast, destroying beach front towns in Mississippi and Louisiana. A million people were displaced and, well, thousands killed as the storm went on. And I look at this most recent poll by the public policy polling people who said 29% of Republicans in Louisiana said that President Obama was more to blame for the bad response from the government than George Bush. Only 28% said Bush was responsible. If I remember right, Obama had been in the Senate for about 8 months at that point. So I guess it just shows the level of hatred toward the black guy in the White House. And anyway, here to talk about what's going on in New Orleans since the hurricane is Alfred Marshall. He's an organizer with Stand With Dignity at the New Orleans Workers Center for Racial Justice. Alfred, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thanks, Rich, for having me on, Rick.
I appreciate you taking time. You know, it's been 8 years, and, you know, people think, most people I talk to say, hey, everything's back to normal. I see on TV, Mardi Gras happens, everything's wonderful there.
Yeah, you know, they picture like it's everything is fine down here. But in actuality, Rick, you know, what's going on is that people have been, you know, we see a gentrification of New Orleans. And Stand With Dignity have been fighting for full and fair employment here in the city of New Orleans. We see billions of dollars allocated for New Orleans. That's, you know, the rise of a new New Orleans that's coming up. But black people is not getting to work. You know, we have been lazy people and, you know, we are ex-offenders. So, if the government is saying that, if these contractors are saying that, we are asking, Stand With Dignity is asking them to train us. If we don't know, allow us to train us. Because all they're providing for us is temporary service jobs, which is not enough.
Yeah, I'm with you. You know, I remember right after the hurricane hit, the response from President Bush was to eliminate the minimum wage and eliminate prevailing wage, basically so people could work for free. and all of the money that we as taxpayers were allocating through FEMA were just ending up in the hands of these big contractors, basically a wealth redistribution from us to the handful of wealthy people in this country without any real economic benefit going to the people who needed it the most, which are the people who live in New Orleans, the people who live in those areas that were affected.
Yeah, yeah, exactly right. You know, the people who was definitely affected by it, you know, they get none of the money. You know, we stay right in the heart of the city. We see all the buildings and all, you know, all the construction that's coming up, and we right there standing before it. And we not allowed to go right in and rebuild. You know, I mean, we right literally across the street from some of the sites where we reside at. One side is rich, the other side is poor, which is us. And when we look over across the street sometimes, we see people that, all the people that don't look like us. And when they do invite us to come in, you know, they want to give us the, all the digging jobs and all the trash picking up jobs. They mean not skilled. So, you know, we've been fighting and saying we are skilled people. You know, given the opportunity.
Right.
That's all we ask for, the opportunity.
You know, I look at New Orleans and I keep telling people, you know, just like, you know, a lot of our bigger cities where you see this, this dividing of America, the very well-to-do, and then the rest of us. That's, in my view, the vision that the wealth class of this country has, the two-class society, the two Americas that John Edwards, Edwards talked about back in 2004, the very well-to-do, and then the rest of us, Alfred.
Yes, of course, of course. We see it plain and blatantly down here. I mean, people don't come together and organize and stand up, demand more for themselves, but then they're going to keep doing what they're doing. We see the wealthy coming down here. You know, we have been pushed out of the city. This city was 90% black. Today, now, you see gentrification everywhere. Where are those people who was affected by Hurricane Katrina?
Well, of course.
It was all...
Well, they were busted. They were busted, if I remember, Houston, where... Barbara Bush said, you know, all the people living in the Astrodome, it's working out very well for them. They like it here. They can't believe how hospitable the Texans have been while they're living in a stadium.
Oh, you know, Rick, to be honest with you now, you come down and see the condition that people are living in today. It's more homeless than it ever been before. You know, our homeless shelters are filled. You know, people are laying under the bridges in the street and being arrested, actually, you know, from just laying under the bridge. We have the highest incarceration rate after Katrina because of lack of the conditions that we are living under down here. You know, they're bringing us to jail and making, you know, free labor, they're getting free labor out of us.
Well, that's probably, that's in my view, one of the main reasons for this. So how do you move forward in this? You know, are there groups like yours who are out speaking about this? I just don't think there's enough organizing and enough people speaking up because, look, the mainstream corporate-controlled for-profit media, they're never going to pick these stories up. All they care about who's feeding their trough. How do we fix this? How do we get the story out? How do we tell the story?
I mean, Rick, it's guys like you and guys, you know, like we trying to put it out there on social media. You know, we do a lot of advocating. You know, we on Facebook, we on Instagram. We trying to get the message out there. It's been hard for us to move this campaign, you know, but for the most part, at the Worker Center, we are working with the NGA. That's the National Guest Workers Alliance and the Congress of Day Laborers. Because we know as a people, you know, we need, all of us need to come together. So we got three entities that's working inside the Worker Center. You know, again, Congress of Day Labor and the NGA. And together we see the exploitation of people that's, you know, coming into New Orleans.
So, you know,
take
me back to the, because, you know, I remember 2005 vividly. It's the year we started this program. Immediately when we went on the air, Labor Day of 2005, this was a story that we covered. Often it was something that we were on every single week talking about what was going on down there and the rebuilding efforts and the waste of taxpayer money that went on to enrich the handfuls while the services just weren't getting to people. Who do we, I guess one, I know the answer, which is the Bush administration is to blame, but how do we make sure that we make folks who have still been suffering 8 years later, how do we help them and make sure this never happens again?
Rich, it's the capacity down here for is health concern. You know, we suffer from imprisonment, we suffer from mental anguish, and I don't have a solution for the answer for exactly, you know, what do we need? Because we need a lot. We need homes, we need houses to stay in, we need better paying jobs. You know, the mentally ill is just, you know, they're going insane. That's why we having the highest incarceration rate. You see guys going around actually, you know, coming up against law enforcement, you know, with their bare hands and getting gunned down. We are there. Law enforcement are allowed to gun us down in the streets of New Orleans and nothing be done. You know, so we need help. We definitely need help. Exposure, I think, would be the answer to that.
Yeah, tell me the story. Are people still living in the FEMA houses? I remember, you know, when we were down there, we saw parking lots full of these little sheds. Are people still living in those?
You know, you got, Rich, you got people living in abandoned houses. You know, I mean, they make makeshift tents, cardboard boxes. I mean, it's just insane, man, what this government is doing to us. You know, we just elected, this mayor that we have under now, you know, Mitch Landrieu. He looks at us like an epitome, man. He don't give us the opportunity that's available there. You know, we're building hospitals. You know, we're building these lavish homes. But again, I say that we're not giving opportunities.
Who is getting these jobs? Where are these people? Where are these workers from? Are they from the area? Are they transients? Who's doing the job then? If local people are not.
I mean, you got influx of people coming from all around the country that's coming in and getting work. You know, our schools have been, you know, ripped apart. You know, we got Teach for America down here. Everybody come from around the country, don't know New Orleans culture, basically white people that don't know our culture and can't deal with our kids. So we don't have schools or anything. We don't have schools, we don't have parks, we don't have no kind of playground. We don't have nothing.
Yeah, and I remember after the hurricane, one of the first things they did was basically privatize your entire school system by firing all of the teachers and setting up all of these charters and all of these private schools throughout New Orleans, which I saw the other day that the Department of Education and the Justice Department are looking into the vouchers and trying to stop some of them going to the schools, because they're saying, look, you're promoting segregation again, which, you know, look, at the end of the day, is it a black-white issue or is it a poverty issue where you just have a large concentration of people living in poverty in New Orleans that have been based on poverty segregated?
Yes, sir. Everything is based. We got the Department of Justice doing a lot of investigation, not only in the educational system, based in the prison system. The Justice Department down here and investigating the police department. You know, we see it all around. You know, we see investigation of the Justice Department. The federal government is down here, but we still don't see what they're doing. It's nothing being done.
Yeah.
You know, they're here, but ain't nothing being done. We still see the condition is getting worse and worse here. You know, and when you speak to somebody out on the street that I'm organizing, some of the people I'm organizing, you know, the mental state of mind has changed. They're not the same. Some of the people I know that I've seen, their mental state has changed. But Rick, what I tell you is this much, you know, this is an example for what's to come for America. You know, what they're showing you in New Orleans, it's to come in America. And if people don't stand up and see what's going on in New Orleans, because this is the testing ground for what's coming to America.
Absolutely. I'm right there, and I absolutely believe that with you. This is the epitome of disaster capitalism and taking advantage of every opportunity to enrich the few over the will and the need of the many. And I look at New Orleans from our time there. We were there right after the hurricane, and it was I couldn't believe that that's my country, and the response down there is what our government had done. Let me ask you, you know, we were there a couple of years ago, and there were still abandoned neighborhoods that had not been touched. Has any rebuilding gone on in the neighborhoods that were just like some of the parishes that were just abandoned? Any rebuilding of those homes, any rebuilding of those neighborhoods in those communities?
Rick, I can tell you, you can take a trip down here. No, they has not done nothing. What is going on in some of those hard-hit neighborhoods, which was a lot of black neighborhoods was hit the hardest? You see, well, they have done nothing. And what they're doing is they're auctioning the land off, because those people who had those houses, they can't afford to rebuild.
Yeah.
So what they do, they just let them decay, and then the city come in and take them, and then they auction them off, you know, for a little nothing, maybe $5,000 for a lot or $10,000, which we don't have. And then you see other people that moves in and buy the land, and they start to rebuild. So that's a part of, you know, their plan to regentrify.
You know, and I think I think most people think that, you know, when FEMA came in, they made all of those homeowners, they made all of those people whole because, oh, we're giving out all this money. Because you hear the news reports, we gave millions of dollars, and you know, the millions of dollars donated, and all this resource is going down there. When the reality is the vast majority of all of that resource that went down, that we thought was helping the citizens who needed it, ended up in the hands of the very well-to-do, and especially a lot of those people on Wall Street.
It benefited the saints, people like Benson and all these big conglomerates, that, you know, press and these other guys, these big corporations, these big developers. That's who benefited from it. You know, we didn't get none of it. You know, the people that was really affected by it didn't get none of it. And those who got it, Rick, right now they're asking for that back. Yeah, the government didn't come back and say, oh, we didn't give you too much. We need to get that back from you.
Yeah, good luck getting blood out of a stone. Last question I've got for you. You know, here we are. This is the 8th anniversary. What do you want people to know? If they take anything from this interview, what is it that the one thing that Alfred Marshall wants people to know about what's going on in New Orleans?
I want people to know that Alfred Marshall and the organization Stand With Dignity will not quit. You know, we're going to expose the government. We're trying to unify our city, bring people together, and we're going to fight for living wages until, you know, to the end of this thing. You know, we're not giving up down here. You know, even though it's a small population now, we have been pushed out. You know, the little bit that's left here, we determined to win some things.
Now, Alfred, I appreciate you taking time for us. Thanks so much. Keep up the fight, and we look forward to talking to you again.
Sounds good, Rick. You know, you just keep doing what you're doing. Keep putting it out there.
Thanks so much, Alfred. Appreciate it. Alfred Marshall, organizer with Stand With Dignity. At the New Orleans Worker Center for Racial Justice. Quick break, right back, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
To the Rick Smith Show.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
America's economic recovery can be measured not only in the performance of stocks, but also of socks. Most economists, pundits, and politicos see the boom in the stock market and say, see, the recovery is going splendidly. But if they went to such stores as Kohl's, Target, and Walmart to find out what's selling, the answer would be socks. Even in the present back-to-school season, usually the second biggest buying spree of the year, sales are sluggish at best, customers foregoing any spending on their kids except for socks, underwear, and other essentials. This is not only an economic indicator, but also a gauge of the widening inequality in America. The highly ballyhooed recovery has been restricted to the few at the top who own the stocks, get paychecks of more than $100,000 a year, and buy BMWs. But meanwhile, the many don't have any cash to spare beyond necessities. Walmart's chief financial officer seems puzzled that there is, as he puts it, a general reluctance of customers to spend on discretionary items. Golly, sir, could it be because job growth in our supremely wealthy country has been both lackluster and miserly? Yes, for jobs today are typically very low-paying, part-time, and temporary, with no benefits. Mr. Walmart man should know this, since his retail behemoth is the leading culprit in downsizing American jobs to a poverty level. In recent months, headquarters has directed Walmart managers not to hire at all or to concentrate on hiring temporary and part-time workers, while cutting the hours of many full-time employees and making it harder for all workers to get the corporation's meager health care plan. This is Jim Hightower saying, Walmart's sales and profits are stagnant today because, hello, even its own workers can't afford to buy anything in the store besides socks.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
Let me say this as emphatically as I can. Who cares about Mitt Romney's tax returns? Secondly, I love the fact that the guy is rich. You got people who are trying to make it seem like being rich is bad.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Today, back in 1786, the beginning of Shay's Rebellion, you may remember from history class back in eighth grade, began in Massachusetts as farmers rose up against the state government, took over a handful. And this was the end of the Articles of Confederation, the beginning of the push towards a constitution that we have today. And, you know, there are those on the right who want to take us back to the days of the Articles of Confederation, you know, very, very loose, very, very weak central government. In fact, very weak government indeed, so that the handfuls can control everything, which, you know, sadly, I see it anyway. The very wealthy have figured out how to control our government. I look at what's going on in New Orleans, and it's just criminal, man. You know, I go back and I think about that, and it's just, you know, when we went down there afterwards, man. And what's interesting to me is, you know, 29% of the Republicans polled down there in that poll I talked about. I think Obama was the one who botched the response when he'd only been in the Senate a couple of months. Amazing. Just amazing. I mean, and, you know, I look at what went on in New York and the money that got into there and all of the push to be rebuilt and in Missouri and all these other places. And there are those who say, well, it's not racially motivated. And look, I'm rarely ever a person who calls things on race grounds. I'll say it's poverty because it doesn't matter. I grew up, and I guess it's part of my upbringing. Part of my world experience is that, you know, having grown up in predominantly a black neighborhood, I saw things in terms of poverty, not black and white. Those colors, that really, it was green. It was, you know, it was wealth. It was the power of the purse more than anything. Anyway, one of those interesting moments of irony. Story I saw in Arkansas. The Arkansas Democrat Gazette published an article. Evidently, the state senator, Jeremy Hutchinson, who is one of the guys, if you remember after the Newtown, Connecticut shooting, one of the guys on the forefront of saying, we need to have teachers with guns. We need to put guns in the classroom. Evidently, he was participating in a training program. You know, reenacting like the Newtown shooting or school hostage situations, but he was participating in an active shooter training. And, well, they have rubber bullets, you know, give it kind of a sense of real. You know, so if you shoot somebody, they know they've been shot. He shot one of the teachers. Evidently, the teacher was confronting the so-called bad guy and he shot one of the teachers. Now, you would think that this would go, hey, you know, I can see how this happened because I'm a big gun guy. No. No, he then changed it saying, well, we'd have trained resource officers in every school. And you know, that would be the thing to do. Wow. Just amazing. Good news on the sequester front. Inspectors are going to go down the number of, thanks to the Screwquester. A new report put out by the Center for Effective Government has pointed out that the number of inspections is going to fall. OSHA hasn't been saying anything, like most agencies haven't said anything about the Screwquester cuts, but they're coming and they're going to harm inspectors. Now, look, you remember during our tour and, you know, for months before, we talked about the big explosion in West Texas, a place that OSHA had not been to, this big fertilizer plant, they had not been to since 1985. We're cutting inspectors. You know, you gotta wonder when you have a system set up that's going to take 111 years to inspect every workplace in the country, maybe you might want to put a couple more dollars into that to think about it instead of saying, no, we're going to Screwquester you. You may remember also in June, a chemical plant exploded in Louisiana. In July, a gas tank plant exploded in Florida. You know, here's the thing. With all of these incidents happening, and there are numerous more that we haven't mentioned, don't you think with 13 to 15 people dying on the job every day, don't you think we'd put a little resource into overseeing what happens on the job? I know regulations kill business. Yeah, I've heard thousands of times. But what about the killing of people? Now, OSHA is going to see their budget cut. Their budget is going to fall to $531 million from $576 million. The House Appropriations Committee is also looking at cutting 22.2%, which would take them down to $443 million. Back to a budget level of 1993. You look at the Mine Safety and Health Administration, MSHA. Their budget would be reduced from 379 to 353 and could see a larger cut. You look at the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, NIOSH. They're going to see a massive cut in their oversight. And you go, well, you know, hey, it's not a big deal. It's a huge deal. Because we've seen time and time again, folks, without oversight, without the cop on the beat, without someone paying attention, guarding the post, if you will, these companies they're not going to police themselves. They're not. But, you know, I guess that's okay. Because there's part of me that says as things get worse, and they will, maybe that's when we'll wake up. Maybe that's when we'll say enough is enough, and we will take to the streets. Maybe we'll say enough with the low pay, enough with the bad conditions, enough with the lack of respect, and take to the streets. Which is what happened today all across the country, in cities throughout our country, as fast food workers said, you know what, enough is enough. There's only so much I'm willing to take, and we're going to stand united for a better way of life. We come back and talk to one of those workers in Missoula, Montana, who is on the strike line today. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You listen to the Rick Smith Show.
Show, changing America for the better.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents, you may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by Ask Me Council 13.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm telling you, folks, we're seeing it. It's been months. This has been going on for months. I told you at the beginning when it was just one, two, three cities that it was going to grow. I told you when it was 10, 20 cities, it was going to continue to grow. Now we're seeing in excess of 50 cities across the country where fast food workers have taken to the picket line saying, you know what, we demand respect. We demand a decent living wage, an ability to support our families and buy our own health care and our own food and our own take care of ourselves. Remember? Well, here we are today, more than 50 cities across the country saying, you know, we demand the right to join and form unions and to collectively bargain, and we want to take care of ourselves. And today, out in Missoula, Montana, Brian Carey was on the picket line. Brian, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for giving time. I'd like to clarify something. We were doing a strike line and not a picket line. There's a legal difference.
Okay, well, you're on strike for the day, correct?
For the day, absolutely, absolutely.
And this was an informational picket to let people know what?
Yeah, well, we're just trying to get the message out there that these are multinational corporations that are running a lot of fast food service industries that are pulling in billions and millions of dollars every year. Their CEOs are being paid millions and millions of dollars, and their workers are being paid minimum wage. They're being paid poverty wages for doing good, hard, honest work. And we're trying to get the message out that it's not okay for these corporations to just work off their backs and to take all the money. I mean, and it's not just, you know, the workers. The management's being squeezed, and the franchise owners are being squeezed. They're making less and less money every year, so there's less and less money to pass down to the system. And these corporations are reaping in the benefits of this.
Is that something that the people that you, and I understand you've been a Burger King worker for 3 years. Is that something the guy who you work for gets as well, or is this lost?
No, absolutely no. I mean, we've been talking with several of our coworkers over the past couple of weeks. We've been gathering information, you know, and we've been going straight to the people that do this work and getting their opinions and their ideas. And we want to voice those, and so we can have a more clear picture of what it is that the workers want, because this is what it is all about. It's all about the people that are doing this work, you know, and we've had lots of support, lots and lots of support, you know, and honestly, there's been some people that didn't want to come out because they were fearful that they were going to lose their job, you know, but we are protected in rights in doing these strike lines, even though we don't belong to a union. We do have the ability to organize and to get better working conditions and wages.
Well, for now, until the Republicans make it illegal to do, here in Pennsylvania, there's a law going through our General Assembly as we speak that would make talking to your coworkers and attempting to organize, that would make that like stalking. And I guess we could start throwing people in jail for organizing, which at some point, I'm sure that our friends on the political right would love to see. But, you know, you bring up an interesting point, and I think it's something that I've been talking about for some time. What we need to have is we need to have workers organizing and demanding some of the profits that they create. And I look at McDonald's, where their CEO last year took almost $9 million. So as a worker in the McDonald's, you'd have to work a million hours in the year at the wage that you're being paid to come anywhere near what the CEO's taking for himself.
Well, exactly. And I did a lot of research on my own. You know, I was approached by a group in Missoula, Good Jobs Missoula, a great group that is trying to get this message heard. And after sitting down and talking with them and listening to some of the stuff, I decided to do some research my own. And I'll tell you what, public records are great because I found out some information about not only the company I worked for, but the company some friends worked for, McDonald's, the Yum Foods Corporation, which owns Taco Bell, KFC, Pizza Hut. And some of these corporations, it's interesting, if you do the math, and their average worker makes minimum wage. And if you do the math, for about every dollar that their average workers made, their CEOs are making $500 to $1,200 for every dollar.
Wow.
And, you know, and so you can start to see how this is a very biased system. You know, they pay minimum wage for hard work. They don't give you full-time hours. You know, a lot of restaurants are cutting hours at 30 hours or 28 at some places. And so you have to have a second job in order to put yourself through college. You know, so I've got plenty of people, you know, that I've worked with that are working 16 hours a day, 5 days a week, to be able to pay for college, and they're still barely making enough money to make ends meet.
How do you do that, though, Brian? I mean, you're working 16 hours a day trying to go to college and paying the bill. How do you have time for study? How do you have time for the work that you're trying to do on the side?
And that's exactly what this is all about. You don't. It's a losing battle, you know. You get into these jobs, and I understand there's a misconception out there that these are starter jobs, and that these are for high school students. And that may have been true 10, 15 years ago, but these jobs are exponentially expanding. And there are people that are much older than myself. I'm in my mid-20s, and I've worked with people, several people, 30s and 40 years old, that have fallen on hard times and that have come into these jobs looking for something. And then they get stuck in there because they're making these minimum wage hours. They're only getting 25 of them a week. And you can't do anything with that.
Yeah.
You can't get an education with that. You know, so you can't better yourself. You can't go back to school. You can't, you know, you can't afford daycare for your children. You know, so it's not just a starter job anymore. And the money that these toll operators are making, they can more than afford to pay us a decent wage and give us full-time hours. You know, and a lot of these corporations have medical benefits and vacation packages, but only if you work 40 hours a week. And they won't tell you until after they hire that you won't get 40 hours a week.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, and you brought up the second job. What shocked me is when McDonald's, a couple weeks ago, when we talked about it extensively, McDonald's and Visa came out with a website that showed you how to budget your money. You know, you guys don't really understand, you fast food workers don't really understand how to budget. So they came out with a sample budget. And you work your first full-time job, and then mysteriously a second full-time job was added into the mix to help you make ends meet, which to me is saying right from the get-go that they recognize that $15 an hour is what it takes to exist in our society.
Oh, they most certainly do recognize it. And not only that, you know, they are the worst enemy when it comes to putting the stigma out there that these are crappy jobs. You know, they're the ones that force that stigma. And I think that, you know, I think on the inside, they're really okay with it because that allows them to pay the minimum wage and to work less hours is because that concession is there in society that these are just starting jobs and that these are, you know, only for high schoolers and that no one's meant to live off of that. And that's just not the case anymore.
I mean, isn't the other point of this, and I think this is a larger campaign than what you guys are fighting is making sure that all work in this country is respected. And it doesn't matter what you do, if you're working at a fast food restaurant or you're sweeping streets or whatever, that there should be some dignity in work and the ability to take care of your family and take care of yourself.
Absolutely. I mean, that's part of the message. You know, these aren't good jobs. They really are. You know, I take pride in my job and I love the people I work with. And that's worth fighting for me because it's not just happening in the food service industry. It's happening in the retail industry. You know, you've seen lots of strikes and stuff with labor workers, with the auto industry, and with, you know, garbage collectors and healthcare industry. It's a pretty common problem, these multinational corporations that think they can pay you nothing to do a lot of work. I mean, I don't know if you've ever worked in a fast food restaurant, but is it actually really hard work? You know,
yes.
You definitely work just as hard as people making $15, $16 an hour. And it's not fair that these corporations are not willing to pay good wages. You know, you really are paid on how easy it is to replace you, you know, and
excellent
that's
point.
Not right.
No, that's an excellent point. I've always said that, you know, in my life, in my working life, the harder I worked, the less I got paid. You know,
exactly.
When I started off, because I worked at a Wendy's for a couple of months over a summer before I went to college back in the 80s, and it was lifting 50-pound buckets and all the meat and all this stuff. It was heavy physical work, and I'm going, but it's just flipping burgers.
You know, and it's more dangerous than I believe you to believe. I mean, you've got fryers that are 400 degrees.
Yep.
You've got toasters that are 600 degrees. You've got a broiler that runs at 800 degrees, and you've got you know, people working that are being paid $7.65. And, you know, and if you took a look into, like, other jobs that have similar hazards, they're making $13, $14, $15, $18 an hour because of those hazardous conditions. You know, food service industry gets paid pretty low anyways, but if you go work for, you know, in most cases, at least in Missoula, if you go work for a mom-and-pop type store, you're going to get $9 to $10 an hour, and you're also going to get a free meal every time you work 6 hours. You know, and fast food corporations don't do that. They pay you these low wages, and then they charge you half price for their meal, which is cheaper food, you know. And so, there's a lot of things that don't make sense and a lot of policies that just seem like it's just in your face, you know, that they don't have to care about the employees. You know, if a customer complains about something, there's a red flag throughout the system. It goes to every single store. Every general manager gets an email and a CC of it. But when a employer, you know, or an employee files a complaint, two, maybe three managers talk to them about it, it maybe gets around, but I really doubt any of those reports ever make it to corporate, anything like that, especially in a franchise store. You know, nothing ever gets there, and the franchise owners are stuck in the middle as well because, like I said before, they don't have any money to pass around either because they're being, you know, taken for all they have, and they're paying, you know, some franchises are paying 75% of everything they make to the corporations.
Can you see the franchise owners being something of an ally in this? Because, you know, at the end of the day, they want quality workers. They want a stable workforce, I would assume, but they're being squeezed from above. I mean, is this not really an argument for these huge overarching multinational corporations who are squeezing everybody along the chain?
But that's definitely exactly what it is. I mean, The whole effort is about if you bring the bottom up, then everything comes up with it. If we can make these jobs better for the people that work them, then you're going to make things better for the general managers, you're going to make things better for the regional managers, and you're going to make things better for the franchise owner. If we can get that message out there, and if we can make a difference, then I think it just goes around easier for everyone.
Before I ask you about what went on today on the strike line, you know, what do you say to the National Restaurant Association? Who just says, you know, they're just kids. They don't have any experience, because that's the frame. And I want that specifically. When people leave this interview, I want them to go, wait a second. You know, what I'm being told in the media, because we keep hearing it repeated as often as possible. And when I go to the McDonald's or the Burger King's or wherever, I'm not seeing a pimply-faced 15-year-old. I'm seeing someone like me who's trying to make a living.
And that's exactly it. In the 3 years I've worked in the fast food industry, I've worked with less teenagers and more people in their mid-20s and above. These are not just jobs, you know, starting jobs anymore. Because of, you know, economic reasons or whatever, some jobs are scarce. You know, there's not a lot of research in STEM jobs and stuff, so there's not a lot of people getting into that. And these fast food jobs is all they have to fall back on. You know, these retail jobs, any of these jobs that are paying low wages, They're easy to get into, but they're easy to get stuck into as well. You know, it seems like if you get into them long enough, then you don't have the time and the money and the ability to get out.
Yeah, and with the schedules that are unpredictable, it's you know, it's even harder to pick up a second job, which always amazed me in looking at the McDonald's and Visa website that said, yeah, you just get that second job. Good luck on which hours. You listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Brian Carey, a Burger King worker. He's been there 3 years. He took place in the strike today in Missoula, Montana. Tell me, while you were out on the strike line, what kind of reaction did you get from folks? Good, bad? What'd you get? What kind of reaction?
You know, And as we expected, we obviously got a couple of negative requests. You know, there's obviously a lot of people that feel if you bring the minimum wage up that the price is going to be passed on to the consumers and stuff like that. And I don't personally think that'll happen because I don't think I think it would be much more financially beneficial to companies to pay their employees more than to raise prices more. But we got a lot of good feedback. I mean, there's a lot of people honking. There was a lot of people giving us thumbs up when they were going by. There's a lot of people, you know, yelling. And we actually had a lot of people that were pulling in to the Burger King we were at and walking up and grabbing a sign. I mean, we just had a stack full of signs there. We were asking people to join us.
Nice.
And we did have quite a lot of people stop and just come up and join us, you know. And, you know, I was talking to a few people that don't work in the food service industry, but they work in a minimum wage job, and they didn't even know this was going on, you know.
And, so, and here's the thing. By you doing this and taking a stand, you're going to help them as well.
And that's exactly what it is. You know, even if nothing changes in the next 2 or 3 years, if we get the ball rolling and we get enough momentum behind this, maybe we can see changes in the next 5 or 6 years and we can leave it better for future generations, yeah. You know, that are coming into these jobs. Because if they keep growing at the rate they are, you know, in another 5 years, it might, you know, we might have a bigger case that these are not just starting jobs, that these are good jobs and that these are jobs people should be able to rely on.
You know, earlier you brought up the auto jobs and, you know, sanitation workers and all that stuff, which paid decent wages. You do realize that those were crummy paying jobs, too, until they organized and demanded some of the profits back, which is why I've been saying for years, the lower end of the wage scale, they need to organize like my grandparents' generation did back in the 40s and 50s and make those truck driving jobs and those retail jobs living jobs.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I really do think that it was strengthening the economy. I mean, if you put more money into the hands of the citizens to spend, I think it strengthens the economy, and I think that's the easiest way to do it. And that's what we're pushing for. I mean, all we want is to be paid a fair wage for the work that we do, you know, because it is, you know, a lot of people dismiss it as, oh, how hard could it be? But I think anyone, if you would put them in that job for a week, I think they would just automatically be like, wow, you know, this is hard work, and yep. I can't believe you do this for this money. You know, I get the feeling that a lot of people saying that these are just starter jobs and get used to it, and I'll go to college, you know, get a good job, they've never done it. You know,
and you do it with a smile on your face is the other part. I'm always amazed at the people who are smiling. Hey, thanks for coming. Appreciate you being here. And I'm going, if I were you, I'd want to reach across the counter and strangle you. I'm doing this for basically nothing.
Yeah. And it's a hard part of the job. You know, it is a little more stressful than you would like it to be.
Yeah. I mean, there's something seriously wrong when the guy selling me the Happy Meal can't afford to buy the Happy Meal.
And that's exactly it. You know, and you do see that. You know, I worked with a lot of people that you know, you mentioned earlier that McDonald's and Visa had come out with that site because apparently fast food workers aren't that great at budgeting the money. And I would disagree, because I think in order to survive in the fast food industry, you have to be very good at budgeting your money.
Absolutely. I mean, because you only have so much of it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, but, you know, that's just what this movement is about. You know, we just want to be paid a fair wage for the work that we do. And we don't think it's out of line at all that these corporations can dip into their pockets a little bit more and increase their wages. You know, the trouble is that these corporations have been making 100-150% profits on things, and now they're used to that. You know, 10-15 years ago, if you told someone that they'd be making 150% profit off of any business, they'd probably think you were crazy. But it happens, you know. Somehow they turn more profit than they put money into it. All the time, you know, instead of just getting twice their money back, they're getting 3-4 times their money back.
They do that by taking it out of your pocket. That's
exactly.
How they make those. And the sad reality, Brian, is that's how they've been making these profits for a generation. They've been stealing it from the workers. And I love the Tea Party people tell me, well, you're talking about redistribution of wealth. You're damn right I am. Just the way it's been redistributed away from you and me and every other working person into the pockets of these big corporations. We need to undo that and go backward, back to the way it was when my grandparents' generation fought for things. I got to give you credit. I did not think of Missoula as a hotbed of organizing activity, but I give you all the credit in the world. Last question I've got for you. Tomorrow when you return to work, what are you expecting?
I expect to go to work and conduct business as usual. I exercise my rights, which I think is exactly what a lot of citizens should be doing more of.
Yes.
And I'm not worried about it one bit.
Good for you. Brian Carey, I appreciate the time. We'd love to have you back as this continues down the road, and I know it will. Thanks so much, and good luck, brother.
Thank you. You have a good day.
You too. Let's take a quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Time to talk.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
America's economic recovery can be measured not only in the performance of stocks, but also of socks.
Most economists, pundits, and politicos see the boom in the stock market and say, see, the recovery is going splendidly. But if they went to such stores as Kohl's, Target, and Walmart to find out what's selling, the answer would be socks. Even in the present back-to-school season, usually the second biggest buying spree of the year, sales are sluggish at best, customers foregoing any spending on their kids except for socks, underwear, and other essentials. This is not only an economic indicator, but also a gauge of the widening inequality in America. The highly ballyhooed recovery has been restricted to the few at the top who own the stocks, get paychecks of more than $100,000 a year, and buy BMWs. But meanwhile, the many don't have any cash to spare beyond necessities. Walmart's chief financial officer seems puzzled that there is, as he puts it, a general reluctance of customers to spend on discretionary items. Golly, sir, could it be because job growth in our supremely wealthy country has been both lackluster and miserly? Yes, for jobs today are typically very low-paying, part-time, and temporary, with no benefits. Mr. Walmart man should know this, since his retail behemoth is the leading culprit in downsizing American jobs to a poverty level. In recent months, headquarters has directed Walmart managers not to hire at all or to concentrate on hiring temporary and part-time workers, while cutting the hours of many full-time employees and making it harder for all workers to get the corporation's meager health care plan. This is Jim Hightower saying, Walmart's sales and profits are stagnant today because, hello, even its own workers can't afford to buy anything in the store besides socks.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Got 5 ways to hold it to account. Be 45 away to snuff our voices out. Can you hear us? Are you listening? No power
accountability. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. So, you know, I got to be honest. I'm glad to hear that people are standing up and fighting back. And you remember, it wasn't too long ago that the McDonald's here in our area, in the Harrisburg area, their owner, one of the franchise owners, keep those pesky labor costs down because, you know, minimum wage is just too much, contracted with a, you would have thought that after the whole Hershey thing went on with the J-1 visa students, you would have thought that this guy would have, I guess it's one of those moments where you go, they're not going to go after somebody. They're not going to catch me. I'm smarter than they are. Local McDonald's franchisee, Andy Chung, he was contracting with this GeoVisions company, who brings people to the U.S. Through the Department of State's Summer Work Travel Program. The idea is that you give foreign exchange students an opportunity to do a little bit of work, make a little bit of money, and see the country. It's, you know, it's so that they see our culture, that they you know, understand what it's like to be an American, you know, and maybe have some of the flavor of work. And I remember as we were marching with these kids who were working at the McDonald's, being exploited, working anywhere from 2 or 3 hours a week to 100 hours a week, or some of the stories were just outrageous. The one girl said she worked like 30 hours straight. And I remember at the time, you know, this was back in March, because it was a cold day. I remember telling them back, talking to these kids and saying, maybe you got the exchange program and the education of what it's like to be a low-wage worker with no rights in this country. And, you know, these are kids who were from Argentina, Chile, Peru, Paraguay, Malaysia, Brazil, all across the world. Throughout Asia, you know, kids who came here with, you know, hey, we're going to be able to make a little money, and we're going to see this wonderful country we've learned about. Well, they got an experience, all right. They got screwed. Well, the news today was that the company, this GeoVision, they're going to be held accountable. Be held accountable. They were fined a little bit. Slap on the wrist. Don't do it again. Promise not to. In fact, you know, a couple of little minor things that came along with it. The number of people that they're going to be able to recruit into the program, for, I guess, 2 years of the probation, will be cut by 15%. The company GeoVisions is going to have to produce a corrective action plan to promise never do it again. We swear. Just like the Hershey thing. And you know what amazed me as I was looking at the story on the McDonald's situation is they went back and they looked at the fines that the company that brought these kids here from other countries to Hershey to work in this warehouse at minimum wage and, you know, just conditions that you and I wouldn't put up with. According to the article, the fines leveled by the Department of Labor were about $356,000. And you're talking about a thousand kids who came here on this J-1 visa thing, where they each paid somewhere in the neighborhood of $3,000 for this cultural exchange program. $365,000 for 1,000. That's $350, $356 per violation. That's not even really a fine. I mean, we're talking a huge multinational corporation who just got, you know, not even a slap on the wrist. They got a pat. And more like a stroke. You know, jeez, just completely outrageous. But I look at this thing with the McDonald's owner, and I remember going to the dwellings where these kids who had come here from other countries came to, you know, because we're going to make some money, we're going to have this cultural exchange. Like 8 or 9 people stuck in the basement of this small house without access to anything upstairs. They had to basically sit there and wait for the phone to ring. They were at will labor. They were quarantined to the facilities, to the house that they paid through the nose to rent with 7 or 8 other people who were just crammed in, and, you know, at will labor. Oh, we need a couple people, you know, lunchtime's coming, walk over. Wow. And, you know, not even really, I'm sorry, I don't think a 15% reduction in the number of students you're allowed to bring in and a 2-year probation. I'm sorry, that's just not, that's not punishment. And oh, I know, they've got to put out a corrective action plan. Swear on the Scout's honor, won't do it again. See, this is what we've done to these companies. We've given them so much that even if you're talking about $356 per violation for a fine, if you get caught, that's too much. See, this is where business friendly is killing us. This is where the politicians that we've put into office are killing us. Because you go, oh, well, they're just J-1 visa students. Yeah, they're from another country. Why does it care if they're exploited? Understand, if they get away with it with them, that drags conditions down for all of us. You see, we used to know that an injury to one was an injury to all of us. That if we let it happen to them, it's going to happen to us. Same thing with wages. We allow poor wages to exist. We all end up in a world of poor wages, poor conditions, and exploitable. Let's take a quick break right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Changing America for the better.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
Here's today's headlines from Workers Independent News. I'm Jesse Russell.
It isn't often mentioned when people discuss the 1963 March on Washington, but after Martin Luther King Jr. spoke, Barrett Rustin took the stage to read a list of 8 demands being delivered to the government. One of those demands spoke directly to an issue grabbing headlines today, as thousands of retail and fast food workers across the country walk off the job, demanding better wages.
national minimum wage so that men may live in dignity.
In 1963, the minimum wage was $1.25 per hour, or $9.52 per hour when adjusted for inflation. Today, the federal minimum wage is $7.25 per hour, below where it was 50 years ago. At the march, the demand was for a wage of $2 per hour, which would be the equivalent of $14.80 per hour when adjusted for inflation. The workers on strike today are calling for an increase in the minimum wage to $15 per hour, nearly the same amount that was demanded in 1963. Julian Bond referenced the walkout in his speech and called on those attending to not sit on the sidelines as dreamers, but instead to be doers.
And so as we go home today, let us remember that the dreamer was also a doer. And as we turn on our TVs tomorrow and see people walking out of places where they're being forced to survive on $7.25 by the thousands, let us commit to join them in fighting to lift up the bottom. Because as the top of that ladder has extended, the tethers at the bottom must be unleashed.
Many of the speakers called for a recommitment to the fight for a living wage. Service Employees International Union President Mary Kay Henry.
Joining together to create good jobs by supporting workers all across this country who have the guts to stand up, join together, and demand a living wage from their employers.
AFSCME President Lee Saunders said the guiding principle should be that everyone share equally in the prosperity of the nation.
We must uphold the principle that everyone who contributes to the prosperity of this nation should share in the prosperity of our nation.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Proud supporter of the union workers who fought, bled, and died for your weekend. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Our quote of the day comes from Willetta Dukes, a homeless 15-year fast food worker. She's an employee at Burger King who has an article in The Guardian, the UK newspaper, The Guardian. She says, quote, "I'm on strike today for the first time in my life, and surprisingly, I don't feel afraid. Like so many fast food workers," she writes, "across the country, I know what it feels like to be truly afraid. Afraid of having your children go to bed hungry, or afraid of having your heat turned off in February, or being evicted from your home." She says, "Today is not scary. Today is empowering." And that's the thing that you find from a lot of people who've taken that step. We're going to go on strike. We're going to make our demands. And you know what? We're going to stand together with our coworkers and demand it. I'm telling you, this is the beginning of something really big, which is why we've asked Megan Ford. She's a Dunkin' Donuts employee in Madison, Wisconsin, to come talk to us about today's events. Megan, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You know, I look at the quote from Willetta down in North Carolina, who, you know, says, you know, this isn't something to fear. This is something that's empowering, something that gives you the strength to move forward. What are your thoughts?
I definitely agree. Although there is a factor of fear, when I turned in my strike slip, I was absolutely terrified. I've never gone on strike before. I never thought it was something that I would ever do. I've read about it in my textbooks. I've read about it in different classes I've taken. I've seen the videos. I've watched the March on Washington. I've watched picketers, but it's never something that I thought I would do. It's one of those things that you see on the news. But being a part of this had made that fear become something internalized and makes you think in a different way that, yeah, maybe I am putting my job on the line, but this is something that is definitely worth it. This is something that I'm working for other people, not just myself, and it really turns into something bigger, and it makes you think of a bigger, more long-term goal that you're working towards.
You know, that's something I hear from a lot of people, Megan, and that's the amazing part of all this. It's not just for you. It's not just for the individual. It's for the common good and for the next generation as well.
Yes, definitely. Like, I just graduated college. I have an undergraduate degree in political science and sociology from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and I've gotten a lot of people ask me, why are you doing this? You could just quit and get a different job. Well, first of all, it's not that easy. And second of all, this is for something else, because when you think about our new economy and the jobs that are available and the jobs that won't be shipped overseas, they're ones that are dealing in fast food. They're ones that are dealing in food service and customer service. Those are the ones that can't be shipped overseas. So more and more people will be in the situation that I'm in right now, despite their education levels.
You know, we hear that a lot, that, you know, if you don't like it, you should go on to something else. But the sad reality in our service-based economy, there isn't really anything else. Those high-paying jobs in manufacturing that have been shipped overseas, those are gone. You know, until we bring back something that's going to sustain a middle class, it's going to take a long fight like this. And I give you guys credit for being out in the streets and highlighting these issues.
Thank you.
So, you know, in looking at the community's response to this, because I got to be honest, I think this is what has to happen. I've been calling for this for years, that the low-wage workforce says, you know what, enough is enough already, and does as my grandparents' generation did, organize collectively and come together and stand for better wages and conditions. What kind of response have you gotten from the community today during the strike?
It's definitely been overall positive. Every single establishment when we've been out, we've gotten horns honked from cars, thumbs up, big fists in the air saying, keep fighting the good fight and keep pushing forward. I couldn't have dreamed for anything better to happen to my fellow strikers and to happen for my fellow coworkers. This really highlights the issue that minimum wage doesn't go up unless we push it forward. It's not tied to inflation. It doesn't go up on its own. Well, costs of living go up and up and up on their own. Costs of wages just stay stagnant, and production keeps going up, and CEO salaries keep going up. But minimum wage isn't going to move forward unless someone stands up. And this is the point where we need to stand up.
I'm with you. But, you know, you hear the folks on the right, the people of the National Restaurant Association, the NFIB, all of these corporate groups saying, you know, Megan, if we raise the minimum wage, it's going to cost you your job. So you really don't want us to raise the minimum wage, do you?
I think that's just fear tactics. Regardless, they're going to need us to serve food. They're going to need workers to do these jobs. And if you look at their salaries, they're going up and up and up, and we're still seeing a bunch of jobs. I heard that McDonald's salary went up last year from, I think it was in the single digits of the millions to the double digits of the millions. So if he can get that much of a pay raise, he can afford to pay his workers a living wage.
Yeah, I mean, the one statistic I saw said that the CEO of McDonald's makes, in order, if one of the workers made what he earned, what he took, it'd be over a million hours in a year that they'd have to work. And I mean, you know, I love the frame that the right gives us, and I love the frame that the wealth class give us. We just work harder. Pull yourself up by the bootstraps. Like the woman in Australia, the billionaire, Gina Reinhardt, who said, well, you just need to work. Work more. Stop drinking and socializing. Just work more. There aren't enough hours in the year for us to work to make that kind of money.
Yes, absolutely not. I have a few coworkers with me at Dunkin' who they work 40 hours a week and still can't pay their bills. They have to find somewhere else to get some sort of money. And there's times where they say, I have no idea how I do it. And their strength and their ambition, it's something that I've never been able to see.
You mean the teenagers? You mean the pimply-faced teenagers that you work with?
Oh, gosh, no. These are mothers. These are fathers. These are people trying to raise their family and better their lives for themselves and their children. And these are full-grown adults who are working Dunkin' Donuts full-time, and they've got bills to pay. They don't have enough money to dig themselves out of poverty. All it is a continual hole.
Are you sure? Are you sure it's not Granny just working for a little extra bingo money? Because, you know, what I'm told is it's, you know, it's the kids, the teenagers looking for that, you know, that's just a little work experience. It's Granny who needs a little pin money on the side. It's definitely not college graduates, and it's definitely not people with families, or so I'm told.
Yeah, I would like to have them look me in the face and say that. I'll show them my diploma and my Dunkin' Donuts apron right next to them and say, really, you want to tell me that it's just people looking for spare change? This is how I make my living.
And the thing that gets me is, you know, I hear a lot of people say, well, you know, it's not that difficult to work. I got to be honest, you know, I've done, you know, fast food work at some point in my life. That's actual hard work.
It is hard work. I work 7 hours a day. Most of the time I don't get to sit down. I'm on my feet. It's customers. Most of them are very, very nice and patient, but you get a few that just think you're just the absolute worst and they don't give you the time of day or the respect that you deserve as a full-grown human being. And it's draining, even just to go into work. If I'm just having a bad day, I have to put on a smile. That's my job. It's emotionally draining as well as physically draining.
Yeah, I see. I couldn't do your job for just about any amount of money because it would be that – and I've seen these people in action. I would reach across the counter and probably strangle one of them. It would be a very, very short day for me.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's definitely a test of my strength to sit there and smile while someone is telling me that I'm an idiot.
Yeah, so walk me through this. You know, what is it that we're asking for? Because, you know, I go back and I think about, you know, my grandparents' generation who took, you know, jobs like being truck drivers and working in restaurants or working in, you know, retail stores and made those jobs, at least living jobs, and in a good case, made them middle-class jobs like factory work, which I've been saying we have to do with the low-wage economy today. You know, walk me through the demands, the things that you think we need to be doing to, make your job better, and also something that you could make a living on.
Sure. The first thing I think is raise the minimum wage. $7.25 is just an insult almost. It's not something that even a single person can live at all. It's all of your money is either going to rent, and then you've got utilities, and then if you're a student, you have student loans. If you've got a cell phone, you have to pay for that. All around just needs to be raised. We're asking for $15, which if you talk about how much production has gone up, the minimum wage should if it was tied to production, it would probably be around 22, but we're asking for 15, tying to inflation. And then also union organizing so that we can ensure that our voices are being heard. Because when you just think about the plain dynamics of a working environment, the employer versus the employer has a massive advantage, just how it's structured. They have the power of the purse, and it can go unchecked.
Yep.
A union checks that power of the purse.
And as the Pennsylvania Workers' Compensation Law states it, the master-servant relationship.
Which
I think puts it into very clear perspective when you're talking about the workplace in this country, especially if the servant has no ability to say anything to the master.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. When you go in that spot, theoretically, bargaining for wages can happen. But when you're just hired and you have rent due the next day and you've got utility bills waiting for you, you'll take anything you can get.
So when you're out on the street today, how many folks participated in your event?
Well, there's two, including myself, from Dunkin' Donuts. We've got a whole bunch. I really couldn't give you exact numbers, but we've been to the Dunkin' Donuts. We've been to two Burger King, two McDonald's. We shut down the Subway because the two employees walked out. We shut down I think either a Family Dollar or a Family Tree or a Dollar General because their employees walked out. We've been all over the city, and it seems like there is more and more interest in what we're doing.
Good for you. To me, this is just amazing news because, you know, as we're talking to people across the country, we're seeing this all across the country. And in fact, I saw one of the stories down in North Carolina where the Burger King owner said, if you just come to work today, I'll pay you double. And I'm going, well, that's kind of the idea here. So,
yeah, I know.
So why don't they just threaten to go on strike every day so that their wages go up?
Yeah, exactly. We've had someone, I think they worked in the food court in Easttown Mall in Madison, and their employer heard that they were going to strike and is like, I'll give you a $3 raise. immediately call them. So we have them scared, and they don't know what they're doing. So all we have to do is push forward and keep moving forward, and we can definitely see this as a reality.
Yeah, let me ask you this, Megan, because there are a lot of people who say, well, the minimum wage, that's just the minimum. We would like a little bit better than minimum. And I look at, you know, as a union person myself, I say, you know, we should have industry-wide contracts, industry-wide standards to where, you know, you pull everybody up, the entire industry across the spectrum, you know, having coming from the trucking industry. Instead of having laws that do it, I'm in favor of direct action like you're doing, to where you're mandating, you're saying, you know what, as a matter of dignity and respect for people on the job, that this is what our industry should pay. And you do that as a matter of contract, not as a matter of law.
Yeah, that definitely sounds viable. But I think just having that guarantee of federal law, because when we were doing the strikes today, I think the biggest sell was saying this is a federally protected right.
Yes.
And I know employers can get around it, and there are certain things that can be done to misstep, but you do have the federal law on your side, and having the federal law on your side is, I think, is a big thing for people.
So when you go back to work tomorrow, as I'm sure you're going to, what do you expect from your employer? What kind of response?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. I'm a little leery about it. I'm thinking they'll be a little upset, probably ask me why I did it, maybe why I didn't just confront them. And basically I'll just say this is a movement that needs to happen. And would you have confronted your manager when you had just started 2 months in and you had so many bills and you were relying on this job for rent? And I highly doubt they would.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting point, because you hear a lot of people say, wow, I can make my own deal. And,
mm-hmm.
and in a lot of cases, people do make their own deal. Sadly, the level of strength, the bargaining power, not quite there. And you end up usually, if you're a worker, with a bad deal.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely. Yeah, we just don't have all the information.
Now, the Dunkin' Donuts you work at, is that a franchise thing? Is it a corporate owned thing? How's it set up?
It's a franchise. I think it's owned by a Wisconsin company out of Wisconsin Dells. They own, like, all of the Wisconsin Dunkins. There's, I think, two, soon to be three in Madison. There's one in Appleton. There's two or three other ones in south central Wisconsin, and they're expanding. So they are definitely making hand over fist, and all they're doing is making more Dunkin' Donuts and making more low-wage jobs.
Yeah. Now, your manager, does your manager realize that by you guys raising your conditions up, and maybe this is something you'll tell them, by making your conditions better, theirs will have to go up as well?
I would hope so. I think that the manager situation is very delicate, because you get kind of this sense of, I guess, being a boss, and that gives you a sense of responsibility. So you think you have kind of a power over someone, but really I think it's just corporate owners separating the workers apart to divide us, so they're giving little carrots so they can keep the big top leaf.
Well, you know, as Jay Gould, the railroad magnate of the 1880s, said, I can easily pay half the working class to kill the other half. This isn't
yeah.
killing them, but this is certainly slicing us up and dicing and pitting us against one another.
Yes, definitely, and it's my hope that people in middle management come to see that their fight is our fight as well. My fellow employee who walked out with me is a shift leader. So he's technically my boss when we're on the clock together. And he was saying that same exact thing when we talked to our store manager. He was saying, don't you understand that you're just as vulnerable as us, and you're in the same pool as we are. You could be gone just like we could be gone, and your situation is bettered by our situation being bettered.
And that's the message from the bottom up. You know, if you make people at the bottom whole, it reverberates all the way up. Megan Ford, I appreciate you taking time for us. Congratulations. Keep up the fight. We wish you nothing but the best, and hope to have you back when this battle is won.
Thank you so much.
Quick break, yes. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
controversial, thought-provoking, opinionated. Rick Smith.
America's economic recovery can be measured not only in the performance of stocks, but also of socks. Most economists, pundits, and politicos see the boom in the stock market and say, see, the recovery is going splendidly. But if they went to such stores as Kohl's, Target, and Walmart to find out what's selling, the answer would be socks. Even in the present back-to-school season, usually the second biggest buying spree of the year, sales are sluggish at best, customers foregoing any spending on their kids except for socks, underwear, and other essentials. This is not only an economic indicator, but also a gauge of the widening inequality in America. The highly ballyhooed recovery has been restricted to the few at the top who own the stocks, get paychecks of more than $100,000 a year, and buy BMWs. But meanwhile, the many don't have any cash to spare beyond necessities. Walmart's chief financial officer seems puzzled that there is, as he puts it, a general reluctance of customers to spend on discretionary items. Golly, sir, could it be because job growth in our supremely wealthy country has been both lackluster and miserly? Yes, for jobs today are typically very low-paying, part-time, and temporary, with no benefits. Mr. Walmart man should know this, since his retail behemoth is the leading culprit in downsizing American jobs to a poverty level. In recent months, headquarters has directed Walmart managers not to hire at all or to concentrate on hiring temporary and part-time workers, while cutting the hours of many full-time employees and making it harder for all workers to get the corporation's meager health care plan. This is Jim Hightower saying, Walmart's sales and profits are stagnant today because, hello, even its own workers can't afford to buy anything in the store besides socks.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Just when you thought it was safe, those crazy Republicans are at it again. It's time for the Rick Smith Show's Conservative Alerts.
The poverty tour, the grand poverty tour. Yes, yes. The Republicans here in the General Assembly here in Pennsylvania, Dave Reed, the chairman of the policy committee, the Republican policy, on the big poverty tour, empowering opportunities. Yes, yes, we're going to give poor people the opportunity to starve. Yes, yes, because, you know, they made a bad decision. It was just one bad decision. You know, they were born into the family they were born into. Check the Facebook page again today. Nothing in the way of actual work. A lot of rhetoric, not much in the way of actual work. As I've said numerous times, you want to help end poverty? A jobs plan. You want to help end poverty? Get people health care. You want to help end poverty? Education. So many things we could be doing, but we're not. Because, well, you know, the very well-to-do need more, you know, because we can't raise taxes on them. No, that would be a bad idea. Anyway, Dave sent me an email. He said, how is it possible that big corporations get away without paying taxes, such as mentioned on the show, you know, AT&T, and why, if they don't pay taxes, should we pay them our tax for their service? Because you don't have lobbyists. I think that's the bottom line. You don't have the lobbyists to get you the big loophole. You don't have the representation in Congress. You don't have someone beating on their door. Look, it's not that the people in Congress are horrible, horrible people. It's that all they hear from are well-paid lobbyists with big checks. And it's an environment where they need the big checks to be able to run campaigns. No big checks, no TV, no radio, no big campaigns. It's pretty simple. And the reality is these huge multinationals, they're killing this country. And, you know, we've been talking about the fast food industry. And I did just a little bit of research during the break on what Burger King, McDonald's, Subway, you know, the Starbucks, these big,
huge conglomerates, what kind of tax rates they pay. And I came across a Reuters article that pointed out that, well, they don't pay all that much in taxes. In fact, last year the report pointed out that in 2010, the average corporate income tax among the OECD countries, the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, was about 25.5%. Where globally the Burger Kings, the Starbucks paid 13% in tax on their overseas income, and McDonald's paid 20, still below the OECD average of 25.5%. And why is that? And they went through and they talked about things, this intellectual property rights, which, you know, hey, you know, you didn't make money off the food. You made money off of our know-how for you to make the food. And this is, you know, a scheme that we've seen replicated on the state level as well. I mean, you look at our Delaware loophole, and the most famous example here in the state is one that's most often cited is Jeffrey Giraffe, the Toys R Us, you know, logo, which I guess was incorporated in Delaware in one of the little magic boxes. And all of the profits that the stores here in Pennsylvania make, well, they pay a huge fee to use the little giraffe figure on the stores, and they suck the profits out of the state, goes to that magic box in Delaware, and gone, no profits, which in turn means no state taxes. That's basically what happens on the international scale. You've got McDonald's and KFCs and Burger Kings and all of them, Subways, which is the biggest chain in the world. You've got them who have these places all over the world, and, well, they find the lowest tax haven that they can find. They incorporate their logo or whatever, something where they're able to, well, you got to pay some of it to the logo, because it wasn't the food, it was the logo. And it's a way that you get to hide, you get to hide your tax money. And according to the article, the use of intellectual property and royalty fees, you know, it's been around for decades, but it spread after who opened up this massive loophole in the mid-90s? Oh, yeah, us. We did it. Because we've got corporations who do heavy amounts of lobbying. And, you know, you look at McDonald's, who, you know, the article claimed does about $17 billion a year in revenues around the globe. And you look at the money that they shield all around the globe. You look at Subway International, which reaps about, according to the article, reaps about $150 million a year in royalty payments from the franchisees in Europe. And you look at the money that's just been sucked out of our tax base. And look, this isn't about, you know, people say, wow, you can't raise tax on small business. Sorry, McDonald's is not a small business. You know, maybe the franchisee who's getting screwed. And in all of this, you know, I've been saying for a while that, you know, they're in the same boat. They're just a little bit, just a couple of rungs higher on the ladder. Because, look, to start a McDonald's, you need to have $1 million. There are very few of us that have $1 million that we can put up of not borrowed money, but of cash money to build one of these McDonald's. So, I mean, they're not in the same boat we are. They're not going without a Happy Meal. But at the end of the day, they're being squeezed like everybody else. And, you know, you would think that as a franchisee, as one of these owners, you would want your workers making a decent living, so they do what? Oh, yeah, buy your product. Even at 50%, most of these workers can't afford it. I mean, it's mind-blowing. So, David, when you ask the question, how do they get away with it? It's pretty simple. They fund these huge think tanks. They fund these euphemistically named front groups, Americans for Prosperity, Freedom Works, Americans for the Love of Dogs and Puppies, and, you know, all of these euphemistic names that don't mean a whole lot of anything other than tax breaks for the wealthy, deregulation, free trade, all of the schemes that have destroyed the American working class, that have destroyed the American dream. So when you ask how they get away with it, we let them get away with it.
because, well, you know, when you start talking about small business, because we care about business, we want jobs. When a Walmart comes to town, do they create jobs or do they cost jobs? The studies have shown that they cost jobs. And in fact, they cost decent jobs. And, you know, you heard in one of the interviews with the guy from Missoula, Montana, who said, you know, in a small business, you know, sure, you make $9, $8, $9, $10 an hour, but, the guy gives you a meal. The small business guy sees your face. He doesn't want you to starve. And for me, I look at how we've allowed these big corporations to grow and grow and allowed the executive class, the CEO class, to be completely removed. Their decisions, they don't see the destruction that they cause. So they're out of sight, out of mind. They live in their gated communities. They live in, fly in their private jets. They live completely separate lives. So the destruction, the despair, and the pain and misery they cause, that's not our problem. And we as taxpayers have set up a system that's allowed them to fund their low-wage workforce with tax dollars. Which, look, I'm not totally against. But you got to have a tax rate that's high enough to support that. You go back to the good socialist years of Dwight David Eisenhower when you had a 92% top marginal tax rate. Then I'm willing to say, yes, we need some loopholes. We need to incentivize things. But when you're talking about a 28, 35, 39% tax code where people end up paying nothing, I'm sorry. There's a problem there. There's a serious problem. You know, even during the Kennedy years when the top marginal rate was 70%, there was still the ability to incentivize. But once Reagan hit down to 50, down to 28%, what are we now paying the very wealthy to be the Milton Friedman idea? He's the guy, you know, Uncle Milty, the extremely conservative economist, Chicago school guy who came up with, he's credited with coming up with, there are a number of people who had the same idea, this idea of a negative income tax, which, you know, and I like the concept. There's got to be a way of making it workable to where if you're working, and it doesn't matter what you're doing, there's a minimum level of income that we say every person in this country has to have in order to survive. It doesn't matter what you're doing. You guarantee that minimum. You got to work, but you guarantee that minimum income. And yeah, it's amazing to me how far the right wing in this country has gone. Ah, you're talking about redistribution of wealth. Uncle Milty, the conservative economist who came up with most of the bad ideas that the Republicans and conservatives and the conservative Democrats have followed for a generation, came up with this idea that, you know what? People who work at places like McDonald's and Walmart, people who work in the low-wage economy, you know, they're consumers too. And they need to be able to spend a little money to keep the system moving. Because you can't have a consumer-based economy without consumers. Look, the Koch brothers can only spend so much. The wealth class can only and will only spend so much. That's never going to be enough to sustain a consumer-based economy. Just not. So, David, to answer the question, it's us, man. We're the ones. We're the ones who have allowed this to happen by voting for the people who keep telling us the same BS. Oh, we need free market trades. We need the free enterprise system. We need capitalism. No, what we need is a sane and rational economy that works for everybody, not just a handful who are able to manipulate the system. At least that's my view on it. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to find out what's going on in Syria. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. Crosses, in the cold ash yard. 97 families who lost 97 farms. I think about my grandpa, my neighbors and my name. It's a nice to be like that.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed. This world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hope of its children.
The good socialist president, Dwight David Eisenhower. Yeah, I mean, today, do you think today he could possibly be a Republican? I don't even think he could be a Democrat, to be honest with you. Anyway, welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. You know, as we're seeing the drumbeats calling to war, I had a guy today who was telling me, we need to go in there and set them straight. And I'm going, really, do we really want to get into another one of these situations when we don't know really what's going on? We know what the media is force-feeding us. But here to tell us what's going on the ground, I've got Zach Badoff. He's a correspondent for Talk Radio News Service right now in Turkey. Zach, thanks for taking time for us.
Of course, thanks for having me on.
You know, we're starting to hear we need to go in there and do a bunch of stuff. What are the conditions right now that you're seeing, and what's the sentiment going on?
It's difficult. It's a complicated situation, of course. I mean, there's so many different factions, and what I've heard from people is they want action, one form or another, from the United States. Whether we like it or not, we're still looked at, I would say, surprisingly, as a world leader, and they're expecting Barack Obama in particular to step up. People who I spoke to in Syria itself, as well as refugees who are in Turkey, where I am, their message to me was, it's not so much about these chemical attacks, chemical attacks, sure, they're awful, that we can all agree on that. But I think the message that the Syrian people have is 100,000 people have died so far. More will continue to be killed. And what they're saying is they're wondering, when is enough enough? At what point will the United States and other Western nations step in and do something? I mean, this was pretty much, it was entirely unanimous for the people I spoke to within Syria, that, that's a mother of five, a free Syrian army soldier, a barber, a cook. Everyone was asking me, when is the U.S. going to do something? It's great. It's basically a disgust at inaction on the West. Now that doesn't mean that they're going to want, for one thing, let's be clear. No Syrians I've talked to have any interest whatsoever in boots on the ground. No foreign troops should be sent to Syria. I think that's abundantly obvious. And I hope the Pentagon is not considering that as an option.
And I don't think any Americans want that. I don't think anybody here in the U.S. wants that. And in fact, a lot of the voices that I'm hearing are the isolationists. We should stay away from it. This stuff kind of happens. I mean, you look at Darfur. We really weren't in a hurry to do anything over there. So why is this different?
I don't know how many people have been killed in Darfur, but in the past 28 months, 100,000 people have been killed in Syria. And I think the difference here is that, it's a massive number of people. It's a slaughter, basically. I think the Syrian people just want to defend themselves. At least the ones I've talked to, You know, so they're basically advocating for different options. You know, they're saying, we can fight for ourselves. You don't have to fight for us, but just give us some weapons. You know, we want to be able to fight against the jets. We want to fight against the tanks. Just today, I was at a clinic that takes care of, that makes prosthetic legs for victims of the war in Syria. This is in, Turkey, very, very close to the border in Reyhanlı. And you know, so there, I met a young boy. He was, I can't remember his exact age, but he was probably about, 12, something like that. And he was injured by one of these jets, the regime bombed. So he lost one of his legs, and, you know, he seemed in good spirits. I saw him take his first step on his own. And it was really amazing. I was so glad to have seen that, after he got his prosthetic limb. But the point of the whole thing is, you know, people are in, I mean, I interviewed other people who have very equally horrific stories, of what's happened within Syria. It's a difficult conflict, but there are ways that I think the United States can be involved to help balance the power, between these different factions that would support the people of Syria. And even I should add, and then I'll stop rambling. I should add that I've talked to nonviolent activists who are not, you know, someone, you know, they're not interested in foreign intervention, but they are saying that these strikes are a necessary evil.
Interesting. I mean, because I look at this and I go, you know, because I don't know that we get all the information here. I mean, the media here is presenting us with, you know, with their side of how we be involved in this and how, what we should be doing going forward. And I look at this and I go, you know, let's say we do say we're going to arm the other side. We're going to give them all the guns and weapons and it kind of, you know, another situation like in Egypt, the kind of, which side are you choosing? Are you creating another bad situation? Help me with this, because I'm struggling. Yeah. I'm struggling to figure out which side is the right side, if you will.
Well, it's really tough. You know, I was talking yesterday with the president of Christian Solidarity International, and you know, basically Al Qaeda has been targeting Christians, and they want to create an Islamic State, and they want to kick out all the Christians, and they've been attacking the Kurds as well. And they've been attacking, you know, pretty much everybody who doesn't agree with them.
Right.
And
I mean, it's so an opportunity. They're opportunists. There's an opportunity to expel the others. So that's what they're going to do. Right.
They're just going into this power vacuum and they're moving in where they see this opportunity. And so, you know, for us in the West, you know, we look at this and we see these Islamists, these radicals, and there are there are definitely some links, between these guys and the more moderate Free Syrian Army. So we have to ask, you know, are the weapons that we provide, are they going to end up in the hands of these guys? I talked to the head of the Syrian National Council, the president, and he said, we can track them. We can have a registry. But I'm a little skeptical of whether once the weapons actually arrive, whether they can accurately track it and maintain control of all those weapons. You know, especially because some of those weapons could end up, you know, being used to target an aircraft that's, let's say, flying over Israel. You know, so it's definitely a concern. And, you know, personally, I think that these strikes on, you know, if they go after, let's say, the Syrian regime's air bases, I think that's a step in the right direction. Because, you know, these aircrafts are you know, a targeting civilians. As I said, 100,000 people have died. That would take a tremendous pressure off the civilian population, and I think that's a step that we can, you know, that would be good. That being said, we have to think about, you know, where do we take this from there? I mean, the White House has said they're not interested in regime change or acting toward regime change. So what is the point? I mean, what are we hoping to achieve here? We're just making some sort of message that we're number one and you can't mess with us and, this, you can't mess with our image of being the best in the world. I mean, I don't really see how this is productive.
Yeah, I mean, but we both recognize what's said in public, and what's said in private are two different things. I mean, you know, while Obama's out there saying, you know, and I think the cables that, you know, that that Bradley Manning put out, I think pretty much highlighted the fact that, you know, what we say in public, not always what we are saying in private. I'm not sure what they really want to do, and I hope they know what the end game is at some point. But, you know, right now, I don't know, like a poker player, you don't want to show your hand too soon. But who would carry out these strikes on these air bases? Because I don't know that I want the U.S. to be the face of another war, set of attacks. I'm not sure that I'm thrilled with that.
Yeah, it's totally understandable. I understand that completely. And, you know, I myself was very much opposed to the war in Iraq. I've had the decision, and by the way, we started on bad intelligence, or at least fabricated intelligence. So we definitely have to be concerned about that. We don't want to rush into anything. That said, there's basically, if you look at the U.S. policy towards Syria, there is no U.S. policy towards Syria. The White House in particular has been tremendously indecisive about what it really wants to do. And in fact, I would say they're doing that on purpose. You know, they would rather create some sort of stalemate. They'd rather have a divided Syria, which is beneficial for Israel, which is beneficial for the United States. And Syrians recognize that. I mean, they know that it's a lot easier for President Obama and, you know, the United States, Western nations as a whole, to just stand back and, you know, let Muslims keep on killing Muslims. And then, you know, nothing happens, and it's better to have a divided Israel, divided Syria that's not a threat to Israel. So, you know, Syrians are very well aware of what's going on here. And, you know, I think they're going to remember this. But also, it's not like they're going to go and attack us. But I should add that I think one of our legitimate threats here is that this Al-Qaeda strength is just really, it's a very powerful presence in Syria. And if we let this fester, it's only going to get worse. And, you know, they're basically, they have control of parts of the country. Now, you know, when I went into Syria, I was just a kilometer down the road. There was a checkpoint where one of the groups called Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, one of them, they control checkpoints. So they have these areas, and unless we do something, I was talking to an activist today who said, you know, we have our bigger threat right now is Al-Qaeda in this country and not the regime. So it's definitely a complicated situation. But at this point, I'm unclear what the White House actually wants to do.
Yeah, I'm with you. So at the base of this, because I think there's a lot of confusion. You know, I guess the big question that I have, and I'm sure a lot of, why is this going on now? You know, if we're not interested in regime change, you know, why is this going on?
We finally got called on it. I mean, you know, the U.S., the White House put out a statement in mid-June saying basically the red line had been crossed. Chemical weapons had been used. So it's not like this is anything new. This has already been proved. I think what happened is you've got these very dramatic, very, very disturbing images that came out, and thanks to activists on the ground in Damascus. And people see lines of body, lines of children, and they say, well, I guess we actually have to do something. It looks like we have a moral obligation here. And I think that's the difference. But I would say that it seems like our policy, you know, the United States policy here is sort of shifting, at least from what I'm reading, toward making some sort of statement that, you know, throw a few bombs at Assad and then call it a day and wag our finger effectively and then let them get back to killing. I don't think anything else is. I mean, I'm a little bit pessimistic here. I really hope I'm wrong. But I don't think much is going to change.
Yeah, that not something I'm thrilled to hear. But you know, I look at, you know, and I use Darfur as an example. I mean, you know, I just looked at, you're looking at almost 600,000 people who have been killed there, and you know, in the genocide that's gone on there, and we did nothing. So I guess the question then for people like me who point to Darfur is, well, we didn't do anything there.
You know, why should we run there? On a geopolitical level, what does it mean if we allow Syria to fall into chaos? What does it mean for the region? And, you know, looking at the Chinese and the Russians who seem to be, or from what the reports are, seem to be the ones holding up any international push to get involved there, what does it mean for that region?
Yeah, that's, I mean, that's a terrific question because it really is a regional struggle. I mean, it's, you've got all those players involved, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Russia, Iran, backing their own horses in this game at the expense of the Syrian people. And, you know, I think, I can't answer your question exactly why Syria instead of Darfur. I mean,
Darfur had no oil, but you know, for me, Syria.
Well, Syria doesn't have much oil too either. Let's be clear about that.
But it's the region, Syria, though. I mean, you know.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's an important. Syria, I mean, holds a pretty important geopolitical place in its location. I mean, it's right at the crossroads.
Yep.
You've got Lebanon, Jordan, Turkey, Iran. I might be forgetting someone else. But anyhow, all these really strategic players, and it's just a proxy battle. And
who are kind of allies of ours. I mean, without, you know, Turkey's kind of an ally of ours, right?
That's exactly right. Yeah, I mean, we've got an air base in Incirlik. An Incirlik air base in Turkey. So, you know, that's another thing to be concerned about. What if Assad decides that he wants to throw lava, chemical weapon over our base there? I mean, we've got, I don't know how many thousand troops there. We've got certainly a good number of American soldiers over there.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of this, this is one of those tinder boxes that I fear explodes and we end up, with the warmongers, you know, with their wet dream.
Yeah, the thing about this for me, though, is I feel like there's really no benefit for the U.S. I mean, it's just a mess. The U.S. is not really, I look at this more on a sort of humanitarian level. I feel like we're not really going to gain anything from getting involved. The only people who will, in some form.
The military-industrial complex?
Well, yes. I mean, they drop a few bombs here and there, but I mean, there's not going to be a massive reconstruction like there was in Iraq or Afghanistan. And we're not going to have troops on the ground, so you're not going to be caught talking trillions of dollars a year. I'm just telling you what I'm hearing from people here.
No, that's what I want to hear.
And that's what Syrians are saying. They want some sort of support. Mostly they're calling for weapons. That's the main thing I've been hearing. But people seem to be supportive of the, you know, other chemical, sorry, rather, of missile strikes as well. They are tired of trying to fight this on their own. And unfortunately, as I said, I think what's going to happen is the U.S. is going to make a few token gestures. We're going to fire some weapons, maybe take out some of the presidential guard on some weapon sites, maybe some aircraft, then we'll go away. And unfortunately, people I'm talking to say they expect the conflict to continue for many years. Someone told me 15 years today. I anticipate more like 2 or 2 to 4, but still, I think this thing is going to continue on for a while.
Wow. So does Assad have any kids?
You know, I don't know if any guy has any kids. He does have a wife who is often wearing fancy jewelry and going to Paris. And
look, I was just thinking about the Gaddafi thing. I mean, you said something in there, kill one of the kids, put like they did to Gaddafi, put him in his place. He then surrenders his nuclear weapons, tries to play nice for a while. Maybe that's something we might have to do.
we'll see if that's one of their tactics.
Saying that facetiously. Zach, I appreciate the time. Thank you for the update. Be safe. We look forward to hearing from you again.
Okay, thanks for having me on.
Thanks so much, Zach Bedoff, correspondent with Talk Radio News Service. Quick break, right back. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
While the poor man pays the band, oh, they're billing me for killing me.
deeply blue in an ocean of red. Rick Smith.
America's economic recovery can be measured not only in the performance of stocks, but also of socks. Most economists, pundits, and politicos see the boom in the stock market and say, see, the recovery is going splendidly. But if they went to such stores as Kohl's, Target, and Walmart to find out what's selling, the answer would be socks. Even in the present back-to-school season, usually the second biggest buying spree of the year, sales are sluggish at best, customers foregoing any spending on their kids except for socks, underwear, and other essentials. This is not only an economic indicator, but also a gauge of the widening inequality in America. The highly ballyhooed recovery has been restricted to the few at the top who own the stocks, get paychecks of more than $100,000 a year, and buy BMWs. But meanwhile, the many don't have any cash to spare beyond necessities. Walmart's chief financial officer seems puzzled that there is, as he puts it, a general reluctance of customers to spend on discretionary items. Golly, sir, could it be because job growth in our supremely wealthy country has been both lackluster and miserly? Yes, for jobs today are typically very low-paying, part-time, and temporary, with no benefits. Mr. Walmart man should know this, since his retail behemoth is the leading culprit in downsizing American jobs to a poverty level. In recent months, headquarters has directed Walmart managers not to hire at all or to concentrate on hiring temporary and part-time workers, while cutting the hours of many full-time employees and making it harder for all workers to get the corporation's meager health care plan. This is Jim Hightower saying, Walmart's sales and profits are stagnant today because, hello, even its own workers can't afford to buy anything in the store besides socks.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
How can we be a people that fight for America if we don't know who America is or what we're all about? This is, in my opinion, a conscious effort on the part of the left, who has a huge influence on our curriculum, to desensitize America to what American values are, so they're more pliable to the new values that they would like to impose on America.
Yeah, war! War, the new value. Yes, we need to bomb things. Blow stuff up.
Yeah, I was looking at FoxNews.com the day before yesterday, and the big headline, huge, bold, type 28 font, bold, underlined, with a very angry, angry New Times Roman font. Any U.S. strike against Syria likely to last hours, not days. And I'm going, hold on. Don't I seem to remember that same kind of argument sometime? Oh, it won't be long for trying. Well, we won't get bogged down, and Colin Powell was wrong. We can break it and not buy it. And now you've got Rummy running around saying Obama needs to go to Congress to get approval. Rummy! This is why I'm not president. I would tell Rummy where to go. Take the fast trip straight to down to where you and Bush and Cheney are all going. Straight to the H-E double hockey stick. Oh, just amazing. If you missed any portion of the program, ricksmithshow.com. Have a great holiday weekend. We'll see you back here on Tuesday.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@thericksmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide flood beneath the sway. Imperialist.